Good afternoon. The Health and Human Service Policy Committee will now come to order. The first item on the agenda is something that was brought to my attention by fiscal staff, and it is House File 2050, the Finstad bill, which we sent to the consent calendar members. I'm told that the wording of the language dealing with the fiscal issue is not something that is complete. It needs to be reworded, and that deals with fiscal records and such as far as stating a certain amount of fee being $75. So I am going to move that House File 2050 be reconsidered, and after that motion, I'm hoping will be prevail, that it would be re-referred to the Committee on Finance so that can be taken care of there. And it does not change the text or context of the bill. It just simply deals with wording the fiscal statement the proper manner. I guess we could, do they have it? Okay, I'm told that members do have the technical fix here in the packet. So at this point, I would move reconsideration of House File 2050. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion does prevail. If the committee would so choose, we can deal with the technical amendment, which is in your packets. It's 2050A1. And it, as I said, it doesn't change the text or the context. It changes the text, but not the context of the bill. And it does move the charge that was in rules to statute. I'm told this is probably the preferable means of doing so by fiscal staff. And is there any discussion at this point? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. And at this point, I would move that House File 2050 be referred to the Health and Human Service Finance Committee. We would be passed as amended and re-referred to Finance. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, Representative Bradley.
Madam Chair, just quickly, I'm assuming that's what the recommendation to pass. And I'm not convinced that we need to see it, but this may be procedurally the right thing to do. And if it turns out later we learn something new, we can dispense with it fairly quickly in the Finance Committee.
Okay. All right. All those in favor of that motion, say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion prevails. Members, we have a couple of bills up before us today, and I have the fortunate privilege of having both of them. And one of them obviously has received a lot of discussion, a lot of lobbying. And I would like to turn the chair over to Representative Powell for this discussion. And I will be taking the witness stand.
Without objections, I think we should probably do the minutes and let's get that out of the way. Do I have a motion for that? Approve the minutes for February 23rd. Representative Wilkin moves. Discussion on the minutes for the 23rd. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion approved. And now the minutes for February 25th. Representative Samuelson moves the minutes for February 25th. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Those are approved. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Boudreau, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to move that House File 2127 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance, Health and Human Service Finance Committee. Before we vote on that motion, Mr. Chairman, I would like to have the opportunity to tell members about the importance of this bill. We do have a delete all amendment that would place the bill in the order, which I wish to present it, and I would like to move this amendment. It does reflect discussions that I've had with opponents of the bill, and I know that those discussions have been ongoing. And once that is moved, I do have a technical amendment, Mr. Chairman, as well. So first, the DE1 amendment.
Representative Boudreau moves the DE1 amendment. There's discussion on that. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion.
And Mr. Chairman, there is the technical amendment. I believe it's the A3 amendment. And it is technical. I would move that as well.
Representative Boudreau moves the A3 amendment. Discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Now, Chair Boudreau, I also see an A4 amendment.
Oh. Mr. Chun, would you explain that, please?
Mr. Chair and members, the A4 amendment is another technical amendment. It changes the effective date for the adverse events, health events reporting section to conform with the rest of the bill, and it changes, it corrects a reference to last year's session laws.
Mr. Chairman, I would move adoption of that technical amendment.
Representative Boudreau now moves the A4 amendment. Any discussions or questions on the amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Boudreau, is the bill now in the shape that you'd like it?
I sure hope so, Mr. Chairman, but you know how that goes. It's always a work in progress. I would just like to address members of the committee briefly. Last summer and fall, I visited numerous hospitals, nursing homes, and clinics, as many of you know, discussing concerns with staff members and citizens about health care and its financing. Over and over again, hospitals shared with me their concerns about the uneven playing field that exists between hospitals and certain, I'll call them niche healthcare providers. In some communities, the financial impact to the hospital from an existing for-profit surgery center or an imaging facility was already being felt. In other communities, there was great fear about the ability of the hospital to provide the full range of healthcare services to the community in the future if current surgical or imaging procedures were to drop significantly. It was with that background and out of concerns for preserving hospitals' ability to fund important community services like labor and delivery and emergency rooms that I introduced House File 2127. There seems to be much misinformation circulated about this bill, and I'm troubled by the tactics that have been used by some contract lobbyists who have been hired to oppose this bill. I've heard that some legislators are getting phone calls from constituents saying that this bill will close down their local doctor's office or local doctor clinic and that they will lose their jobs. This is certainly not true, and it's unfortunate that something like that would even be said. For the record, I would like to clarify just a few key points before others speak. First of all, this bill calls for the licensure of two types of healthcare facilities, outpatient surgery centers and diagnostic imaging facilities. Outpatient surgical centers are already licensed in rule. However, those rules focus on building code issues, and I am proposing to add patient safety and some financial disclosure requirements. Every existing outpatient surgery center, whether it's owned by a nonprofit hospital, by a physician investors, or a joint venture of a hospital and a physician group, will be grandfathered in. No existing facilities will be denied a license, and the fee will remain the same as they are currently paying under state rules. It is true that this bill calls for diagnostic imaging facilities, which currently are unlicensed, to now be licensed, and that they will have to pay an annual fee of $1,512, the same amount paid by the surgery centers. Quite frankly, I was shocked to find out that these facilities are not licensed. The bill does impose some patient safety standards and financial disclosure requirements. Once again, it's very important to state that all existing imaging facilities will be grandfathered in and no one will lose their jobs. In addition, I would like to point out that all existing facilities would be allowed to purchase any new equipment, make any capital expenditures, or expand their capacity at their existing location without any approval from the Department of Health. This bill is not a return to a traditional certificate of need policy, as some have alleged. This bill does call for a prospective review process, but only for new outpatient surgery or imaging facilities in a new location. This requirement is applied to future facilities, whether they are proposed by physicians or by hospitals. The patient safety and financial disclosure regulations are also evenly applied. Opponents of this bill would like to reduce the argument to a competition good, regulation bad soundbite. Of course, regulation can add some administrative costs, but it is just as obvious that the failure to regulate can create even more substantial costs and harm for many more people. The final point I would like to make is about the misinformation that's being circulated on the issue of physician self-referral. I have a memo that was written on February 25th from the Center for Diagnostic Imaging that says, this legislation will greatly affect where and how you can refer patients to outpatient surgical centers and imaging centers such as CDI. This bill requires, that is a quote, unquote. This bill requires disclosure of physicians' ownership when referrals are being made. It does not ban physician self-referral. It just asks physicians to tell their patients that they have either a financial interest or financial benefit. The real public policy question is whether it's smart to regulate entrepreneurship in the specific areas of surgery centers and imaging. Who pays and who profits? Who wins and who loses? This bill ensures that it is the community that wins in the long run. At the end of comments from the proponents of the legislation, I'd be happy to answer questions that you have. And at this point, I would like to introduce the first testifier, Jeff Spartz, the administrator at Hennepin County Medical Center, to make a few comments.
Mr. Spartz, welcome to the committee. If you state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeff Spartz, and I am the administrator at Hennepin County Medical Center. I would like to thank the committee for the time they're taking today to consider this bill. I am testifying as the Secretary Treasurer of the Minnesota Hospital Association. That includes all 139 hospitals that currently operate in the state. I administer Hennepin County Medical Center, which is a 462-bed Level 1 safety net trauma center. And we also, by our calculations, provide about 20% of the total graduate medical education that's done here in the state. Hospitals and their affiliated clinics are the backbone of the healthcare system in Minnesota. We provide a delivery system that is there 24/7 and has access to everybody when they need it. During the course of a year, our member hospitals provide care to about 500,000 inpatients. They also provide outpatient care to about 5 million individuals. We collectively employ about 100,000 people. And the good news there is that you can't, at this point in time, move us offshore. We have to remain in Minnesota, and our people pay their income taxes. The Minnesota Hospital Association strongly supports House File 2127. Hospitals all across the state are in support of this, including Fairview System, the Alina System, Park Nicollet, Health East, and the Greater Minnesota Hospitals. And I believe a Mayo Clinic representative will speak a little later and outline their views on the bill. The goal of the bill is to sponsor fair competition between hospitals and niche providers. I've just been told that there are some members of the legislature who believe that this bill does not create a level playing field. If there is language in there that doesn't provide for that, we'd be happy to see an amendment that does assure everyone that there is a level playing field. We're not attempting to do an end run here or to play games. Healthcare is changing rapidly. More and more we're seeing movement to outpatient procedures, away from the hospital setting, diagnostic test options that we never thought of 10 or 15 years ago. But people continue to rely on nonprofit hospitals for their care, such as the emergency rooms that hospitals have. And we have fixed costs with operating those because those are stand-ready facility, And when our revenues go down, our fixed costs do not change. As health care changes, we need to update the rules that govern it to make good public policy so that what makes sense today makes good sense tomorrow and into the future. Otherwise, we can see current trends leading to serious harm for the state safety net providers, the hospitals. What's happening here is, you know, hospitals are required to provide, in order to operate, a number of services that lose money. We hopefully can operate enough services to make a little money at the end of the day, you know, because we need that money to reinvest in our people, our plant, and our technical systems. In the short term, a hospital can operate in a deficit or a break-even position. In the long term, that hospital is going out of business if it can't make a reasonable profit for reinvestment purposes. We believe consumers should get information and have the information they need to make wise choices in their health care. The business community, labor, provider organizations, and community advocates all have broad agreement on the importance of giving consumers useful information. This bill would give consumers for the freestanding facilities the same information they now have available about hospitals. We're trying to work closely with physicians on this. We've worked closely with the physicians in my own medical center, and I've heard from physicians who understand why such legislation is needed, and they share the concerns about preserving the community safety net facilities, the hospitals. This bill only deals with surgery centers and imaging facilities that currently provide service to about 7% of the state's, 7% of the state's clinics approximately. And we just want to apply the same patient safety and reporting standards to these facilities that hospitals and their clinics comply with every day. I want to thank you for your time, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. A number of other hospital leaders are going to speak following me, and the next one is Mr. Tom Thompson, who is the CEO at St. Mary's Medical Center in Detroit Lakes.
Thank you, Mr. Sparks. Mr. Thompson, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Tom Thompson. Mr. Chair and members, I serve as president of St. Mary's Regional Health Center in Detroit Lakes, a community of 7,000, 1 hour east of Fargo. A member of the Catholic-sponsored Benedictine Health System, St. Mary's mission compels it to serve the poor and the powerless of its community. Our medical staff is comprised of local physicians affiliated with Fargo-based Dakota Clinic and Maricare Health System, two organizations that are both St. Mary's partners and its competitors. The Detroit Lakes healthcare market is split three ways between St. Mary's and the physician organizations for most outpatient ancillary therapeutic and diagnostic imaging services, and one of the clinics operates an outpatient surgery center. A fourth diagnostic imaging facility is opening in March that will include the community's second MRI. St. Mary's medical staff expects and service area residents need access to a full complement of quality community hospital services. However, escalating competition from physician organizations and niche providers for profitable services and technologies makes the hospital the most vulnerable provider due to the lack of leverage we have over patient referrals, more costly quality and staffing standards, 24/7 operating requirements, and acceptance of patients regardless of ability to pay. Consider the example in Detroit Lakes of ultrasound services. Since both clinics offer ultrasound services, the hospital only serves patients after the clinics close for the day, or when the clinic services are unavailable, or when the needed procedure requires the higher skill or technology level that we maintain at the hospital. It is quite honestly difficult to justify maintaining this service at the hospital. However, we must maintain the service at the highest standard because of the need to care for complications and emergencies that arrive in our ER at any time of the day or at night when the other providers in town are closed. The freestanding MRI facility that I mentioned earlier that's opening in March has the potential to cause an operating income loss of about $200,000 annually for St. Mary's. That's roughly 20% of our operating income. Policymakers and the public need to understand and should care about the rapid escalation of niche providers and the resulting toll on the ability of hospitals to capitalize and operate essential hospital services. St. Mary's is one of the state's most efficient community hospitals. Yet there are many safety net services we offer to meet the public's need, like our nursing home, home care, ambulance service, assisted living, housing, etc., that operate on a narrow to no margin and are subsidized by those services, especially those we discussed today, that are the targets of niche providers. The same math is true for any community hospital. Unfortunately, hospitals will become more dependent on government payment, not less, if we continue to lose these profitable services. The vulnerable state of community hospitals calls forth the need for a review process to ensure that the next niche provider or service in Detroit Lakes doesn't critically affect St. Mary's ability and its viability and force us to discontinue any services or halt any investments that are in the best interest of our medical staff and the communities we serve. Ironically, our medical staff, who in this instance serve as a niche provider, are reliant on us. They need us not only to be viable but vibrant. As such, some kind of review makes sense. You can think of it sort of as an environmental impact statement for healthcare. In closing, I understand that the new niche provider review included in this bill is controversial. Yet, does anyone here believe that it's cost-effective for the employers in Detroit Lakes, and that includes the state of Minnesota as well, to be paying for a clear oversupply of healthcare facilities? Also, do we believe that Detroit Lakes residents don't hear media stories about the high cost of healthcare and then look at four imaging facilities in our town of 7,000? These are additional reasons to create a pause in this development process and put in a common sense review before new niche providers set up shop. Thank you again for your time this afternoon. And at this time, I'd like to turn over the microphone to Peggy Sietsema, who is Chief Nursing Officer and Associate Administrator for Clinical Services at Rice Memorial in Wilmer. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Thompson. And would you please state your name for the record, please?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Peggy Sietsema, and I would like to also invite Sue Stout from the Minnesota Nurses Association to join me here at the podium. As I said, my name is Peggy Sietsema. I am a Chief Nursing Officer and an Associate Administrator for Clinical Services at Rice Hospital in Wilmer. I've also been a registered nurse for the past 36 years. Rice is a 136-bed city-owned hospital in west central Minnesota. In addition to our hospital beds, we also have 71 nursing home beds. Rice serves as a regional referral center for the area, providing services to our neighboring communities that they are unable to provide themselves, things such as mental health services, oncology, orthopedic surgery, and neonatal intensive care. We have seen firsthand the impact of competing niche providers that can have on a community hospital. Last year, one of the clinics in Wilmer purchased a new MRI and CT scanner for their clinic. Prior to this addition, the only MRI and CT scanners were located at the hospital. Now that Wilmer has two of each of these machines, which are vital to providing care to our patients, the imaging volumes of the hospital have decreased. However, as a hospital, we still need to provide and staff 24 hours of care, 7 days a week for MRI and CT. We now find ourselves in a position where those procedures are now more expensive to do. On a more positive note, we do collaborate with the same clinic that put in the MRI and CT to jointly operate an outpatient surgery center. By collaborating, Rice and the clinic can provide more affordable outpatient surgery options to our patients and to our community. By working with the clinic, Rice was able to retain some of the revenues that would have otherwise been lost had the clinic built the surgery center by itself. But however these facilities are owned, surgery centers and imaging facilities should be held to some common sense standards, the same kinds of standards that the state holds hospitals to. I can remember when far more procedures were done on an inpatient basis. Medicine has changed for the better, and so many things are now done on an outpatient basis. Our regulations need to catch up with the times. All surgery centers and imaging facilities should be expected to comply with basic licensing, quality, and patient safety standards. House File 2127 will assure patients throughout Minnesota who have surgery or imaging tests in an outpatient setting that they are receiving care that meets the same high quality and safety standards set for patients having surgery in a hospital. It's shocking to think that in the 21st century, surgery centers or imaging facilities performing invasive procedures are not required to have policies to prevent things such as the transmission of HIV or hepatitis B. I believe if the public was aware of this, they would be outraged, and appropriately so. It is shocking to think to know that should a surgery center perform a wrong site surgery or give a wrong medication that would have a significant adverse effect for the patient, that center is not required to report those errors. Instead, current law in Minnesota allows them to keep those errors a secret from both the patient and the public. Our hospital is one of 60 in the state that have an attached nursing home. The review process in this bill gives the state a chance to consider just what kind of impact new surgery centers and imaging facilities will have on existing essential care resources, not just to the hospitals themselves, but to the full continuum of care, including nursing homes, such as the one that we have. I would now like to give the microphone to Sue.
Welcome, Ms. Stout. Please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Susan Stout. I'm a registered nurse, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Nurses Association, which is the professional association for registered nurses in Minnesota with over 17,000 members statewide. I'd like first to thank Representative Boudreau for bringing this important legislation forward, and Representatives Powell, Huntley, Nornes, Finstead, Samuelson, Soderstrom, Dempsey, Pimar, Opatz, and Tao and Otremba for serving as co-authors of this legislation. Thank you very much. The members of MNA have taken a position in support of the bill before you, not because any of our members have a particular financial interest in any of the facilities described in the bill. We are not aware of any nurses who own interest in surgical centers or diagnostic imaging facilities. Nor are nurses in any great danger of finding themselves without a job because of the failure or the success of these facilities. We are in a severe nursing shortage today, and nursing jobs can be found in every community. What did motivate our membership to speak up is a concern about the quality of care that is provided to Minnesota citizens and an interest in correcting a marketplace disparity which places community hospitals at a competitive disadvantage. This disadvantage places at risk hospitals' ability to continue to provide the care that is essential to our communities. On the issue of quality of care, nurses have been expressing for some time concern about the number and type of surgeries that are provided on an outpatient basis and what we see as an inappropriate overuse of this setting. But we understand that in some circumstances, outpatient surgery is the best choice for the patient. Too often we see situations where patients receive their outpatient surgery and are sent home barely awake from their surgery and functioning at a level that is entirely inadequate for them to understand their discharge instructions, let alone to ask the necessary questions to clarify what needs to be done if complications develop. If we were talking about simple mole removal or a minor surgery, we would not be concerned. But we're doing major surgery today on an outpatient basis. An emergency room nurse recently told me the following story of a patient who was admitted to her ER. I'd like to relay that to you. The patient was admitted complaining of bleeding from a drain that was placed in the patient's chest the day before in an outpatient surgical center. The drain was placed in her chest following a mastectomy that was performed due to breast cancer. The patient went home with instructions to watch for bleeding and to make sure the drain was not dislodged. During the night, she bled through the dressing and did not really understand how much bleeding and discharge to expect from the drain. The patient ended up in the emergency room in the very early hours of the morning because managing the post-op course was just too difficult. She didn't know how much bleeding was too much, and she was afraid to change or reinforce the dressing for fear of dislodging the drain. While the bleeding problem was a real difficulty for the patient, the patient's extraordinarily high stress level was an even greater problem given the nature of the diagnosis and the surgery. She and her family were totally unprepared to handle the post-op course, and they suffered fear, anxiety, pain, and uncertainty for no good reason. Now, I don't believe that anyone would have been discharged from a hospital in the same situation as this patient. The patient would have been kept until she was ready to go home. She would have had professional nursing assessment at discharge, and the standards around discharge instructions would have prevented them from sending her home as ill-prepared as she was. The bill before you today seeks to require outpatient surgical centers to meet the same nursing and quality standards that are met by hospitals. Now, whether or not the legislation before you will prevent the reoccurrence of this type of problem may be debatable. However, it is the position of M&A that is certainly worth trying. On the issue of equalizing the competitive playing field between hospitals and outpatient centers, M&A members want you to know that we believe our community hospitals are an important asset to preserve. Leaving hospitals to provide the care that is often unreimbursed, such as emergency room care and charity care, or under-reimbursed by insurance companies, HMOs, and sometimes government, while simultaneously allowing outpatient centers to peel away the profitable parts of the hospital business, is a recipe for disaster. Community hospitals will only be able to manage in this market for a limited period of time. If hospitals fail to survive because outpatient clinics and diagnostic imaging centers take away all the business that helps them to balance their books, the real losers will be the citizens of the state. And I thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Stout.
Thank you for listening to our comments, and I'd like to turn the microphone over to Randy Ulseth from Mora.
Mr. Ulseth, if you'd state your name and proceed, please.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Randy Ulseth. I am the administrator of Kennebec Hospital, a 45-bed hospital owned by Kennebec County. Thank you for this opportunity to share our views on House File 2127. Kennebec Hospital is part of a rare breed. It's one of the few Minnesota hospitals that isn't currently fending off significant niche provider competition, at least not yet. So I'm speaking today as someone who has concerns about this trend and as someone from a community that would benefit in the future from this legislation. The niche provider challenge isn't just created by physician-owned facilities. The legislation calls for review of all niche providers, regardless of whether the service is proposed by a physician group or another hospital. It truly creates a level playing field. Kennebec and Pine County, like many rural counties, is older and poorer than the state as a whole. Well, that may be changing as the metro area grows. We have more Medicare patients in our hospital than the average hospital. We also have more medical assistance patients, Minnesota Care patients, and uninsured patients. Because of that patient mix, I am particularly interested in the provisions in this bill that require all surgery centers and imaging facilities to treat patients enrolled in public programs if they also want to provide services to state employees and receive payments through the state workers' compensation program. Hospitals are required to treat all patients who come to our emergency rooms. Surgery centers shouldn't be able to avoid this same commitment. This legislation creates some common sense regulations on this, ensuring that these niche providers can't cherry pick the most well-paying patients and ignore the folks on government programs and the uninsured. Thank you for your interest. Jim Hankel, President and CEO of North Country Health Services in Bemidji, will speak next.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Hankel, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Jim Hankel, and I am the President of North Country Health Services in Bemidji, Minnesota. Our hospital has 98 acute care beds, and we also have a 78-bed skilled nursing facility as our nursing home. I'd like to tell you briefly about what has happened in Bemidji. In 2001, an outpatient surgery center opened within 100 yards of the hospital's surgical suites. It has four surgery suites, just one less than the hospital. The surgery volumes in our hospital have dropped by more than 30%. Our net revenues since that time have fallen $4 million. While our revenues have fallen sharply, we are unable to reduce variable costs to the same degree. As a result, our costs per procedure have risen dramatically. For example, our cost per unit of anesthesia has increased 57%. But we still need today the same number of anesthesiologists and anesthetists, just as often, to assure that that our surgery patients have appropriate anesthesia services. On a per-case basis, of course, outpatient surgery centers may be less expensive. That's because they focus on the healthiest patients and operate only during working hours. They also don't have to subsidize emergency rooms, home care, nursing homes, and other critical services. But Minnesotans need to think about the overall cost of the healthcare system. And at that level, it seems clear that overall healthcare spending will increase when duplicative healthcare services are added to a community. For example, if my family were to buy a third car, even if it is an old beater, my household's transportation costs go up, not down. I still have three cars to insure and license and maintain, although my family and I may not drive any more miles than we have in the past. There can be unintended consequences when physician self-referrals drive utilization. The U.S. Congress has long recognized that it can be an obvious and unavoidable conflict of interest for a physician to simultaneously be in the business of caring for patients, owning a healthcare facility, and referring patients to that facility. We just saw the President and the Congress pass a law that reaffirmed the need to avoid these conflicts of interest under the specialty hospital moratorium. Unfortunately, the risk of self-referral with outpatient surgery centers and diagnostic imaging facilities has not been addressed at either the state or federal level. This legislation has the foresight to address the self-referral issue by requiring financial disclosure, which will allow the public to know if conflicts of interest occur. We currently have a don't ask, don't tell policy on quality at niche providers. The loophole in current law protects outpatient surgery centers and diagnostic imaging centers from reporting their medical errors. This is unacceptable for consumers seeking information on quality care, and it is unacceptable for employers and purchasers seeking to buy services that they know are high quality. Without mandated quality reporting, consumers and purchasers are on their own, having to guess and hope that the surgery center they've selected will do a good job. Members, North Country Health Services is the largest hospital between Duluth, Fargo, and Grand Forks. We average over 100 inpatient admissions a week. If not for our hospital, residents in northwestern and north central Minnesota would have to travel literally hours for 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week vital services, such as provided by our 22,000 patient per year emergency room, 880 births per year, home care and surgery and the like. Our increase in ER services alone exceeds 30% since 1998. If not for our hospital, our nursing home and home care services and other subsidized services would be in serious trouble, as each incurs substantial operating losses each year. Thank you for this opportunity to share why this legislation is important to Bemidji's hospital.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thanks, Jim.
Mr. Jim Million, if you would take a seat. Thank you for coming. I'm beginning to take a look at the clock, and we do have several more people. If we could keep our comments to 5 minutes, and we'll get through this and be able to discuss it afterwards. State your name, please.
Thank you. James Million of Friendly Fridley, Minnesota. I come today as a consumer, only to testify as a consumer from personal experience, and I come to testify against the proposed legislation. Because I believe we all have reached agreement that reengaging consumers in the healthcare formula is vital to utilization and cost modification, the logic to support outpatient treatment centers without additional frivolous regulation is clear. We need them. As we consumers begin to pay a greater portion of the provider billing, we rightfully demand the benefits of receiving high-quality services through better pricing, convenience, and personalization. From my personal experience, I respectfully suggest that outpatient surgical and imaging centers currently further these goals. We should not promote any legislation that threatens a strong personal doctor-patient relationship unless we see significant evidence of quality problems with EOP centers. Additional regulatory control is frivolous, serving only to increase provider costs, patient expense, and market dysfunction. I suspect this proposed regulation is put forth to repair the brick and mortar of the big institutions, financially tuck point, if you will. The irony here is that it was the hospitals that spawned the move to outpatient centers with detached billing so that the centers could operate on less revenue due to the fact that the exorbitant hospital fixed overhead factors were mostly not apportioned to these centers, even when physically bound within the hospital's brick and mortar. It was all part of the move from inpatient to outpatient treatment in response to cost pressures as well as technical advances. The OP concept succeeded so well that the large institutions now wish to restrain the trade of competitors through frivolous and costly regulations. Is it because others made this concept more effective? Outpatient centers are far more convenient for patient use, given the simple billing system, geographic access, technical specialization, and quick medical feedback they provide. I'm now going to give you two personal examples, so I'm going to waive my HIPAA privacy rights. I'm sure you're all concerned about that. And I have not cherry-picked these examples. They just happen to be my two most recent outpatient encounters. First, I want to talk about an encounter on outpatient surgery, specifically gastroenterology. I've had OP colonoscopy procedures at Mayo Clinic, Abbott Northwestern, Piper Institute's OP Center, and most recently at Metropolitan Endoscopy Center at Minnesota Gastro's new consolidated clinic in Plymouth. Patient convenience, comfort, and expense are all improved at Minnesota Gastro by the fact that I can get the procedure done down the hall from my doctor's exam rooms. Because the billing is expedited by the consolidated Minnesota Gastro business system, not the best on the block, by the way, charges are billed quickly and EOBs are issued within 2 weeks. In 20 years, I have had 8 or 9 colonoscopies among these facilities. The Plymouth procedure in July of 2003 was billed to Medica at $702, reduced to $344, so my 20% coinsurance payment was $6,880. The same procedure, now almost 3 years ago, by the same physician, using the Piper Outpatient Center, billed out at about $880 and was reduced to about $420, and my 20% was $84. It cost me a little over, less than, what, about $15 less this last time than 3 years ago. While the Piper building is closer to my home, drive time is less to the Plymouth facility. The prep and recovery functions are far more efficient, personal, and better supervised at the Plymouth facility. Because Minnesota Gastro has perhaps the best scheduling system of all, wait time is less there for all appointments, including my recent procedure. The new Plymouth Center offers me superb quality, greater privacy of procedure, more personal service, and lower cost. We all win. I've also previously had these procedures done at Abbott Northwestern. Because OP patients are blended with inpatient patients, the OP wait is longer depending upon preference given to more urgent IP patients, as should be the case. Billing, supervision, and convenience are typical of hospital inpatient infrastructure factors, the very reasons the hospitals move the procedures to attached but separately established OP billing units. At the Minnesota Gastro facility, the doctors run the show, as in the old days we all miss. There is a better focus on the patient and a more astute focus on the financials, benefiting all parties to the contract. They can process more patients per day because they are scheduling similar procedures in a well-controlled setting, the very same attributes that gave Mayo its quality and cost efficiencies. I've been through their mill several times as well. The Minnesota Gastro facility offers me the highest quality, greatest privacy, and most personal contact of all my experiences. Let's look at my outpatient diagnostic imaging encounter. When OP organizations such as the Center for Diagnostic Imaging were established, they created more efficient revenue centers as well as a more flexible and efficient means to obtain sophisticated radiology services quickly, saving all parties time and money. I've used the Abbott Northwestern Basement Radiology Chile facility for CT scans in the past, to be sent to Minnesota Gastro for my consultations. The same IP priority events as discussed in the first example also apply to this process. The experience took 3 times as long at Abbott as at CDI. The CDI process was also not a group experience as it was at Abbott. When my foot was fractured in November of 2002, I saw a top foot and ankle man at the Orthopedic Center in Eden Prairie, and he needed CT scans within 2 days' notice for a consultation on Friday afternoon. So I went to the CDI site most convenient to me in Coon Rapids for scans on Friday morning prior to the 3 o'clock consultation. The CDI Center is a clean and professionally equipped facility in a small strip mall off Main Street just east of Anoka. On the inside, the facility appears as reassuring as any other professional office. The staff is as well-trained as any I have observed, and the equipment is certainly up to date. The scans were taken, read, and sent to my doctor by noon, long before the consultation. I was back in our car within 1 hour. Consequently, when I needed to procure copies of these original scans this past December, the Ortho Center simply called CDI with authorization to pick up time. The following morning, the copies were in my hands. Can you imagine getting this level of service through any large institutional bureaucracy? Again, all parties won by using CDI. OP centers provide access, expertise, personal attention, and lower cost. CDI centers are open well into the evening, reducing emergency room visits and higher claims costs. All traditional facilities have given me high-quality treatment. I've used Abbott as a base example because it is my preferred traditional provider. I believe it to be the best hospital facility in Minnesota and have directed most of my care to Abbott since 1989. So my observations compare the best of one system with perhaps the best of independent OP systems. Hospitals are inherently cumbersome bureaucracies. The chance for error or other quality lapses is on the side of bureaucracy every time. I believe the OP centers offer the best healthcare quality and value because they are internally better controlled. I see absolutely no reason to further regulate the OP operations of either CDI or Minnesota Gastro. So who are we talking about here? If we do have some bad actors, Minnesota of all places must already have sufficient regulatory remedies. Economic protectionism reduces competition, promotes inefficiencies, and lowers quality. The proposal before you appears to be protectionism, pure and simple. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Knight. Next on my left is Dr. Paul Mattson.
Thank you.
Welcome.
A couple of handouts, if I may.
Those are the page.
One handout is a cost comparison, and the percentages are between a hospital and a surgery center. And they are by two different payers.
Very good.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Paul Mattson. I'm the president of the Minnesota Medical Association, a physician from Mankato. On behalf of over 9,000 members of the Minnesota Medical Association, I appreciate the opportunity to come here today and share our concerns with House File 2127. In the interest of disclosure, I will tell you that my clinic, together with the multi-specialty Mankato Clinic, constructed and own an ambulatory surgery center. And I'm proud of the high-quality, cost-effective care that that facility allows us to provide our patients who choose that option. And we also provide 24/7 coverage at our hospital. Now, you've been told that this bill is intended to improve patient safety. You've been told that this bill is in the best interest of patients and consumers. And you've been told that this bill is intended to level the playing field between hospitals and other facilities. But we are disappointed with the scope of this bill, particularly those sections that take a giant 20-year step backwards in providing lower-cost, patient-centered, accessible health care services. As policymakers, you have an important job. You must balance protection of the healthcare infrastructure with promotion of innovation and competition. To accomplish that balance, the impact on healthcare costs, quality, and accessibility need to be considered. This bill fails to consider these important dimensions, and it's our firm position that this bill is a misguided solution in search of a problem that needs better definition and a collaborative response. In particular, I'd like to address two main provisions of this bill. The first, Section 1, that calls for licensure of diagnostic imaging facilities, and the second, Section 10, which seeks to reinstate a certificate of need process for future imaging facilities and ambulatory surgery centers. But also ask that you remember the historical context which has led to the development of outpatient facilities. With the expansion of managed care throughout the 80s and 90s, identification of more cost-effective services was encouraged. There is strong argument that part of the goal succeeded in that there's been a reduction and a substitution of expensive hospital-based care for less costly office and outpatient services. Section 1 of this bill would require any non-hospital-based diagnostic imaging facility defined as a center that has more than 50% of its revenue from imaging services be licensed by the health department. We fail to understand the rationale for this proposal. The professionals who work in these facilities, the physicians, nurses, and radiology technicians, are already regulated by the state. The state also appropriately regulates x-ray machines and radiation sources. But what is the quality or the public protection issue that is generating this license proposal? What is the concern unique to imaging facilities? Why is licensure above and beyond current regulation reasonable? If the intent of the proposal is to better, or if the intent of the proposal is to better control the acquisition and distribution of imaging equipment, then this bill does nothing to accomplish that. In fact, our review of data submitted by the Minnesota Department of Health shows that over two-thirds of all capital expenditures reports that include an imaging component were submitted by hospitals and hospital systems. Imaging facilities represent only 28% of all filings. Among other things, diagnostic imaging facilities, as you've heard, offer an important value: accessibility, geographic accessibility, financial, and timeliness. They provide a reasonable option to many patients, and quite often at a significant convenience and a lower cost. Data from a large payer, which you've been provided in Minnesota, demonstrates this fact. On average, payments to hospitals for an MRI of the spine are nearly 1.5 times the payment to an outpatient facility. As all of us look to address the rising cost of health care, it's imperative we pursue and not stifle high-quality, cost-effective options. Let me talk about financial accessibility to care. The suggestion that this bill is needed to trigger compliance with current regulations that require physicians to accept medical assistance, GAMC and Minnesota Care, is without merit. Physicians have both an ethical and a legal obligation to provide care to patients regardless of the source of their payment, and Minnesota Rule 101 requires this. This bill is described as leveling the playing field. Then why, in the area of patient disclosure, are physicians employed by hospitals specifically exempted from disclosure requirements required of independent physicians? Now I'd like to turn your attention to Section 10 of the bill. Don't be fooled. This section is not simply a review process. It clearly establishes a certificate of need process, but only for new imaging facilities and ambulatory surgery centers that are not affiliated with hospitals. Are we to assume from this new language that ambulatory surgery centers and imaging facilities are acceptable, but only if the hospital has a monopolistic hold on their development? Such language clearly demonstrates transparent motivation behind this bill. On behalf of the Minnesota Medical Association and its physician members, we find this proposition unsupportable. The MMA has long opposed certificate of need as ineffective and administratively expensive. The state has supported that policy since 1984, when CON was repealed. Since that time, market forces and innovation have modified the way healthcare is being delivered. The fundamental question before you today: how does the bill help Minnesota? Specifically, on the dimension of cost, quality, and accessibility, how does the bill help Minnesotans? According to data from two large health plans, which I provided, the actual payments to hospitals for knee arthroscopy, a very common procedure, range from 143 to 151% of the payment to ambulatory surgery center. Tonsillectomy payment range is 162 to 206% to the hospital. Colonoscopy, 121 to 177%. In general, 1.5 to 2 times higher for identical procedures performed by the same physicians. Cost matters. It matters to employers, it matters to state policy makers, and as you've heard before, the changing nature of insurance benefits with increasing deductibles and copays, it matters to patients. The quality of health care delivered at ambulatory surgery centers is high, as is patient satisfaction, as these centers are very focused, as you've heard, on the type of care delivered. Specialization yields high quality and high satisfaction. If, however, there are identifiable opportunities for improving quality, let me be clear about this. If there's identifiable areas for improving quality ambulatory surgery centers or at our hospital, such as the expansion of adverse reporting requirements, the MMA would welcome the opportunity to support these solutions. A CON process will not improve quality of care. I'm almost done. Thanks. I recognize that many of you have been told these facilities represent a threat to the financial security of your community hospital. Where is the evidence? This bill will not solve the financial concerns of community hospitals. And I do need to express the MMA's frustration with the process used to bring this bill before your body. On multiple occasions, the MMA attempted to meet with and discuss the bill with the Hospital Association leadership, and we were flat out rejected. And we would welcome the opportunity to understand the scope of the problems confronting Minnesota hospitals. Is it a public program payments? Is it the concentration of population in the metro area? Are the issues similar or different among rural and urban hospitals? We would be happy to participate in such discussions and work together to find solutions to complex problems within the healthcare industry. But this bill is not the solution. And make no mistake about it, the bill as it's written is an attempt to control the marketplace and will increase costs to Minnesotans. I thus urge you to oppose House File 2127. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Mattson. Next testifier on the list is Mr. Terry Tone. Welcome to the committee, and please let's try to limit our comments to 5 minutes. Thank you.
I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak and the support and issue today. My name is Terry Tone. I'm the administrator at Affiliated Community Medical Centers based in Wilmer. Affiliated Community Medical Centers is a multi-specialty health network with 10 clinics in west central and southwestern Minnesota. At ACMC, we have more than 150 physicians and mid-level providers serving the patients in 14 counties. In our service area, we work with 7 different hospitals and provide health care to approximately 265,000 patients and seeing more than 500,000 patients annually. Our rural population is both older and poorer than the state average. Access to health care is more difficult with structural barriers, which include fewer health care professionals, distance available to medical facilities, and less technology. As a result of these challenges, there's a need to balance cost, technology, and value in the care we provide. At ACMC, we are opposed to House File 2127 and its implication for health care in our rural communities. In an effort to best serve the needs of our patients, ACMC currently has within its structure a number of ancillary services which would be negatively affected in the future by this bill, which include ambulatory surgery centers, imaging centers, and breast centers. These centers allow us to provide immediate and comprehensive services to our patients. The passage of House File 2127 would restrict the ability of future technologies and ultimately affect the timeliness of diagnosis and treatment of our patients in our areas. Nearly 50% of the patient visits to our Wilmer facility are from outside the Candio High County area. Many of these are Medicare, nearly 50%, patients who have driven a great distance to receive the specialty care that we offer. Through our surgery center, imaging center, and breast center, we are able to provide these patients with same-day, on-site specialty services. If these services were not offered in our clinic, our patients would need to reschedule and redrive the same distances for similar service delaying care. While we recognize that our hospitals provide a valuable inpatient service, they simply do not have the scheduling capabilities to accept patients on demand or same day. For this reason, there is a delay in diagnosis and treatment of the patient illnesses, not to mention higher costs. To offer a specific example, prior to offering stereotactic breast biopsies in our clinic, a breast cancer patient would have endured several days of testing at different facilities and ultimately have a lumpectomy done in a surgical setting at the hospital. The total time required from start to finish for this diagnosis was nearly 2 weeks at a cost of $6,000 to $10,000. This puts an enormous strain on the family and the patient while waiting for the diagnosis. The same patient now can have a mammogram, diagnostic mammogram, ultrasound, and ultimately stereotactic breast biopsy performed in our clinic and receive the results within 24 to 48 hours at a cost of less than $2,000. In our surgery center, we were able to provide for both screening and diagnostic colposcopies in less waiting time and at the third the cost of an inpatient facility. As a result, we are asking you to reject this bill. Our patients have the right to choose where they receive their care. The ability to offer choice in service allows for a competitive environment where a higher price is not dictated to the public. Clinics such as ACMC require the ability to add technology in their locations and clinical settings to improve access, shorten diagnostic time, advance treatment, and reduce costs for the patients in our community. Passing this bill would be an enormous step backward in providing the care we currently offer to our patients in Wilmer, but in other locations as well. Our specialty services are local. They're cost-effective, they're timely, and comprehensive to our patients. We are not an outside niche agency or entity. We are not cherry-picking the profitable services for this, as this bill depicts. We reside and work in the community in which we serve and take care of patients. And I want to thank you for the time to give you.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Next testifier is Robert Brigham. Welcome to the committee. State your name, and again, please, 5 minutes.
Thank you, and good afternoon. My name is Bob Brigham. I am the Senior Administrator for Mayo Clinic Rochester Hospitals and a member of the Mayo Clinic Public Affairs Committee. I am here today representing Mayo Clinic in Rochester and the 23 clinics and 7 hospitals in rural Minnesota that make up the Mayo Health System. With me is Kathy Miley from Mayo State Public Affairs Committee and a senior member of our legal department. While Mayo physicians are members of the Minnesota Medical Association and Mayo hospitals belong to the Minnesota Hospital Association, and I am personally a member of the Minnesota Hospital Association Board, I want to make it clear but I speak today only for Mayo and Mayo Health System. Mayo would like to thank the Minnesota Hospital Association and Representative Boudreau for bringing the very important issue of survival of our nonprofit hospitals before you for discussion. Mayo Clinic and Mayo Health System appreciate their efforts to address the issue of unfair competition and the viability of nonprofit full-service hospitals in Minnesota. We share MHA's concern about assuring the quality of care for persons receiving medical services in a fair and equitable regulatory environment. Mayo is here today to speak in opposition to part of the bill before you. We support those portions of the bill that establish similar requirements for outpatient surgical centers and diagnostic imaging facilities and hospitals. But we oppose Section 10 in the Delete Everything Amendment presented today that establishes a prospective review process by the Commissioner of Health as part of issuing your license to one of these facilities. Minnesota's nonprofit and public hospitals have a long history of taking on the burden of providing primary and emergency access along with a full range of medical and surgical services for all patients. We support the portions of the bill that impose patient protections and benefits such as financial disclosure, quality information, availability, and open access with regard to payment source on all facilities offering similar services. But the law should not impose inequitable or inconsistent requirements on any facility. In our view, the prospective review section of the bill is inequitable and should be deleted from the bill. Mayo has long opposed excessive regulation of healthcare delivery from the discussions about formal certificate of need process in the 1970s, to the imposition of the moratorium on hospitals in 1984, to the establishment of expenditure reporting as an alternative to certificate of need in 1992, Mayo has opposed government review and prior approval of decisions on establishing health care services. Since 1992, we have consistently sought repeal of the expenditure reporting and retrospective review law. Whether we call these regulatory procedures certificate of need or some other name, the fact remains that the process removes the final decision-making authority from the entity proposing to offer the service and subjects this business decision to review by a governmental entity through a process that is not required for other health facilities and businesses. There is a law prohibiting hospitals from establishing a new location or adding additional bed capacity, but no other entity offering acute health care services in Minnesota is subject to the regulatory process proposed for diagnostic imaging facilities and outpatient surgery centers. Even hospitals don't need permission to start new services or expand existing ones. As we read the bill in its current form, we are not certain that the prospective review process will apply to many new outpatient surgery centers or diagnostic imaging facilities that might be built. There are exceptions to the prospective review for hospitals starting these facilities or for new facilities that are owned or operated in cooperation with an existing hospital or group of physicians. It seems to us that the exceptions are so broad that the only facility that would need to go through the review process is one that could not convince the local hospital and doctors to join in owning and operating. Likewise, if an independent group wants to avoid the prospective review, they could buy land before this bill becomes law and wouldn't have to work with a local hospital or doctors. The bill includes many sections of the Minnesota law that outpatient surgery centers or diagnostic imaging facilities would need to comply with. Minnesota supports these Mayo supports these sections. These include requirements to be licensed and inspected, to accept and treat Minnesota Care, medical assistance, and general assistance medical care patients, not just insured or private pay patients, to adhere to uniform nursing standards, to make quality information available by reporting medical errors, to comply with the Bill of Patient Rights, to disclose financial conflicts of interest to patients. Finally, in our review of the bill, we note that outpatient surgery centers or diagnostic imaging facilities are not included in the list of facilities that can use the peer review law for activities looking at quality improvement in their operations in the same way as hospitals or doctors. We assume this is a minor oversight and would suggest adding these facilities to the definition of review organizations under the peer review law. In closing, we would once again like to thank the Minnesota Hospital Association for its advocacy efforts on behalf of Minnesota's hospitals. We urge this committee to remove those portions of the bill that impose prospective review and approval on the licensure of new facilities and to add outpatient surgery centers or diagnostic imaging facilities to the peer review law. Thank you for the opportunity to share our perspectives with you on this today.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on my list is Mr. Peter Daly. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Peter J. Daly. I'm an orthopedic surgeon in St. Paul practicing with Summit Orthopedics. I come to oppose the bill and give my representation on behalf as the Ramsey Medical Society president. I'm also a co-owner of a surgical suite surgery center that is Medicare certified and licensed by the Minnesota Department of Health. And I own that in cooperation with the remainder of my orthopedic single specialty medical group. I want to emphasize that as a physician practicing in Minnesota, we need hospitals. I need a hospital, patients need hospitals. As a physician and as a surgery center utilizer, I'm not in the business or in the trying to achieve closure of any hospitals. Nonetheless, outpatient surgery centers have been shown to have higher patient satisfaction rates than outpatient surgery similarly performed at a hospital. Outpatient surgery centers have lower complication rate than the same outpatient surgery performed at a hospital. The infection rate at our surgery center after 9 years and greater than 10,000 cases was 0.2%. The national hospital-based outpatient surgery infection rate is 4.1%, a 20-fold difference. Access to have cases done expediently for both the surgeon and the patient is much easier facilitated in an outpatient surgery center. That's why hospitals are trying to partner with physicians and build them. The growth of surgical volume was 1.9 million in 1989 for outpatient surgery cases. It was 9 million in 2002 and projected to top 50 million by 2006. The cost of doing outpatient surgery will double and perhaps triple if hospitals have a monopoly on cases and there is no alternative for outpatient surgical procedures. On this past November 18th, I performed a knee arthroscopy at a large hospital in St. Paul, and the bill the patient showed me from the hospital was $9,500 for an hour experience there. At our ambulatory surgery center for the identical procedure, the charge was $2,300. The reimbursement at my surgery center for that same procedure is between $650 and $1,200. The reimbursement for that procedure at a hospital is between $1,800 and $3,100. Why would this legislative body want to reduce access, reduce service to patients, and dramatically increase the cost of performing these procedures when there is double-digit increases in the cost of medical care at this time? I want to thank Representative Michael Paymar, who is my local district representative, for meeting with me last week regarding this issue, and he presented some questions that the Minnesota Hospital Association had proposed to him that he asked of physicians opposing this bill, and these are some of my responses, and a handout summarizing this has been given to you. We've been asked as to licensure and inspection. Our surgery center is licensed by the Minnesota Department of Health, and we're inspected yearly or available to be inspected yearly. We undergo strict standards for safety similar to any Minnesota hospital. We would welcome adopting any additional reporting requirements such as HIV or hepatitis B transmission, but I'll emphasize that we are under the guidelines of the Centers for Disease Control, a federal institution, as well as OSHA guidelines to comply for that issue now. Regarding the patient bill of rights, that was a document drafted for inpatient care. We've had that posted in our reception room of our surgery center for years. If our patients weren't happy with our service and results, we question why our patient satisfaction rates are higher than hospital rates for similar procedures, which is published data and referenced in your handout. Ambulatory surgery centers have no desire to hide mistakes as stated in the Minnesota Hospital Association memo. I sit on the risk management board for Midwest Medical Insurance Corporation, our malpractice carrier. I'm on the board of directors for that company. It's my business to keep doctors educated to stay out of trouble. Hiding mistakes is not in our best interest nor in the patients. We'd be happy to report any complications to any board in the state. Regarding the doctor's plan to maintain financial viability of the emergency rooms put at risk by these niche providers, I would state that ambulatory surgery centers have already saved the payers and the state programs huge amounts of money by simply being in existence thus far. We have lower charges and reimbursements every year. Our Attorney General, Mike Hatch, has exposed the higher cost structures, administrative structures, etc., of the hospital-based programs, including Alina and others that he's experienced and investigated in the past year. There is room for savings in some of those systems. Regarding whether we're opposed to disclosure requirements, I can tell you we're absolutely not opposed to that. Full ownership disclosure has been printed in our patient literature for the past 5 years at my surgery center, and a copy of that's in your handout. Why would our patients care if they're getting excellent medical care and superb service with minimal complications at a lower cost to the system? My primary care colleagues employed by hospital-based systems in the Twin Cities, and I can cite three specific ones if requested, have made it known to me that their salary bonuses are dependent on maintaining greater than 90% penetration of surgical and imaging referrals within their system. That's their 20% salary bonus at the end of the year. I'd say that's a direct financial interest in their system. And we'd welcome disclosure both with parity for employed physicians and unemployed physicians such as myself. In closing, one other point, I'm sorry. Ambulatory surgery centers, the issue about not having to give free care. That's absolutely true for hospitals. They don't have to give free care in this state. I've taken my patients who are uninsured and tried to bring them to a major hospital in St. Paul, and they say they want a payment plan up front, and if they don't get 50% of the money up front, it doesn't get scheduled there. So this accepting a patient with no insurance only applies to EMTALA, which is showing up to the ER for an emergency visit, not for outpatient elective cases. Our surgery center operated on over 100 patients last year who had little or no insurance, which represented 10% of our volume, and were mandated to report all charity care on a biannual basis to the state. In closing, the question about fair competition with physicians and niche providers in Minnesota between hospitals, I find that a fascinating question when the other eight questions proposed to the legislators suggest eliminating competition from another source. So finally, we agree that we should compete on quality, service, and low cost to the consumer. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on our list is Mark Kleinschmidt. Sir, would you state your name and again hold the comments to 5 minutes? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Kleinschmidt. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of St. Paul Radiology, and I'm here today representing them and the Minnesota Ambulatory Healthcare Coalition. Members of that coalition are listed on the last page of my testimony, which is being sent around. St. Paul Radiology has 84 radiologists and 225 non-physician employees. We are one of the three largest private practice radiology groups in the country. We provide professional radiology services at 11 East Metro hospitals, and we also operate 7 freestanding facilities. Last year, we provided interpretations for more than 900,000 x-rays, mammograms, CT scans, MRI scans, and other radiologic exams and procedures. 90% of those exams were performed in the 11 hospitals we serve. The remaining 10% were performed at our imaging facilities. St. Paul Radiology and the Minnesota Ambulatory Healthcare Coalition opposes and is troubled by House File 2127. It unnecessarily pits physicians against hospitals at precisely the moment when collaboration and cooperation are needed most as we try to repair a faltering healthcare system. The most recent example of such physician-hospital cooperation occurred in the last 3 weeks when the Board of Trustees at DIT Hospital in Faribault approved an agreement with St. Paul Radiology to provide professional interpretations for magnetic resonance imaging exams. The agreement provides the citizens of Faribault with two important benefits. One, it provides patients and their physicians with access to highly trained subspecialty radiology services, something generally unavailable in most outstate communities. And number two, it allows patients to remain in Faribault and receive high-quality diagnostic services without leaving the community. In addition, St. Paul Radiology will also be providing coverage through the night to District 1 Hospital. Consequently, to this partnership, and I stress partnership with District 1, a St. Paul Radiology physician will be on call through the night. If an accident occurs at 3 a.m. in Faribault, it's likely that a St. Paul Radiology physician will provide the radiologic diagnosis. This relationship with District 1 is replicated by other groups within the Ambulatory Healthcare Coalition. I know that the gastroenterologists represented in the coalition and the surgeons at the Midwest Surgery Center have provided 24/7 coverage to their hospitals for decades. To be clear, St. Paul Radiology and the Coalition support efforts to address problems faced by all hospitals, whether they be rural, suburban, or urban institutions. House File 2127 provides no remedies for these problems. And I would like to briefly address two claims that have been made to support this bill. Supporters claim first that the bill, quote, levels the playing field between hospital and freestanding surgery centers and diagnostic imaging facilities with respect to licensing and regulatory requirements. And this is represented to be a quality issue. Second, supporters claim that the bill is designed to prevent freestanding facilities from, quote, skimming the cream, unquote, off of hospital services and requires them to accept patients with government-funded insurance, including the state medical assistance program. Please allow me 1 minute to discuss each of these claims. First, imaging centers are, in fact, already highly regulated. The American College of Radiology certifies MRI and ultrasound programs at imaging centers. The State Department of Health regulates, inspects, and provides oversight to all facilities that use equipment that emit ionizing radiation. The federal government regulates mammography services through the Food and Drug Administration's enforcement of the Mammography Quality Standards Act regulations. And the state of Minnesota and the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission regulate the use of radioactive isotopes used in nuclear medicine imaging. Similarly, surgical centers are also highly regulated. Surgery centers are state inspected and licensed, and additionally, they are regulated under federal Medicare regulations as well as other federal laws. What does this mean? The freestanding surgery centers and imaging centers in Minnesota are highly regulated already and have in place measures to ensure that high-quality services are performed both in hospitals and at imaging centers. The second claim is that imaging centers skim the cream off the hospital's diagnostic imaging services and that they don't accept all patients, including patients with medical assistance or other government-funded insurance. A little history. St. Paul Radiology began offering imaging services in a freestanding setting in the 1970s. Because hospitals were not able to purchase CT scanners or were at that time unconvinced of its efficacy. Then in the 1980s, St. Paul Radiology partnered with several East Metro hospitals to bring MRI scanning to St. Paul. This partnership continued for several years.
If I may interrupt, you're going to have to wrap this up.
Okay.
Thank you.
The state of Minnesota, the healthcare system, employers, and the public must be committed to establishing collaborative relationships as we struggle to address the significant healthcare issues we face. House File 2127 does not address these important issues. It simply serves to further polarize two important players in this debate, hospitals and physicians. St. Paul Radiology is committed to continuing our collaborative partnership with our hospitals as we work to address these high-priority problems. We need an honest and open discussion between the stakeholders on this issue. Instead of working against each other, let us all step back and work together in a comprehensive way to solve these problems. On behalf of St. Paul Radiology and the Minnesota Ambulatory Healthcare Coalition, I urge you to vote no on House File 2127. Thank you.
And thank you for your testimony. Do we have a final witness?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would have like to have the opportunity to just make a few statements. First of all, what I've heard today is a lot of concerns about patients not being able to utilize these existing clinics. I have no idea how that would be thwarted. First of all, access to those clinics is not, there's nothing to prevent that. I mean, it's ongoing. I just want to mention also that The issue here really is about fairness and licensing standards, reporting and disclosure standards, medical care standards. If what I heard today is that a lot of these facilities, and most of them have said they're already meeting those standards, then what is the opposition to having this in statute and requiring it? If it's not a burden, it shouldn't be a burden. But I don't understand. I guess, you know, I guess the whole point here is making sure that consumers are aware and patients are aware of all of the standards that are required by other medical entities, and assuring that the clinics that they're utilizing can provide safe and reputable service. And that's all that this bill will require, is that would be in writing that they provide it. I have someone here from the Hospital Association. I have David Feinwax, who if you have questions, I would like you to direct them there. And he may have some comments, too.
Mr. Chair, members, good afternoon. My name is Dave Feinwax, and I'm General Counsel for the Minnesota Hospital Association. And in summary, I would just like to say three things. Representative Boudreau was exactly correct. Much of this bill is common sense, needed patient safety measures, which virtually everybody concedes are either already being done or should be done universally and would seem to be relatively uncontroversial. One of the things we all agree on is that in today's healthcare market, or lack thereof, usable consumer information is essential if we're going to do anything with rising healthcare costs or reforming the system in any significant way. And this measure goes a long way towards providing that information. And finally, and perhaps most controversially, this bill is not certificate of need, but does in fact fill the role of an environmental impact statement as certain types of services seek to proliferate in the marketplace. And we believe that this is a measured and appropriate response.
Thank you. Any questions for either the bill author or Mr. Feinwax? Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Representative Boudreau, I did support the original bill, but I was very skeptical about the certificate of need portion. And if you look at what's in the DE1, basically it took what would have been a even playing field and converted it into an uneven playing field in favor of the hospitals. And if you look at page 1 of the DE1, lines 12 through 16, it says, the commissioner shall not require an outpatient surgical center or a diagnostic imaging facility licensed as part of a hospital to obtain a separate outpatient surgical center or diagnostic imaging facility license. So we're exempting in that section hospitals from any regulation in terms of outpatient facilities. And if you would go on, Mr. Chair and Representative Boudreau, I don't remember if this was in the original bill, but on page 3, lines 7 and 8, it says account for more than 50% of the facility's total revenue. So again, unrelated in this case, however, to out-of-patient surgery and imaging centers. It says that basically that a hospital can add as many MRIs as they want to, and there's no limitation on that. And then if you go on to page 6, which is new to the Delete All Amendment, it talks about how you get a pre-license review. And again, it says the Commissioner of Health shall blah, 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 do whatever. But if you go down to lines 30, it says this section does not apply to, and then if you go over to sections on the next page, 5 and 6, what it's really saying is that this section does not apply to an outpatient surgical center or a diagnostic imaging facility owned and operated by an organization jointly owned by a hospital. Section 6, an outpatient, again, this is saying that the bill does not apply to it, an outpatient surgical center or a diagnostic imaging facility licensed as part of a hospital, regardless of the location of the outpatient surgical center. So what this delete all amendment does is say that hospitals can put up out-of-patient surgery centers, out-of-hospital surgery centers or out-of-hospital imaging centers without getting the review from the Commissioner of Health.
Mr. Chairman?
But if it's not owned by a hospital, they have to get permission from the Commissioner of Health. So I would like the author to explain why these features got added to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and
Representative Boudreau,
for the opportunity to respond. It's never been my intention to give the hospitals an advantage in this process, and I understand that it was the assumption, at least my assumption, that hospitals had a different standard to adhere to and did need to get prior approval for these kinds of additions. But I will have Mr. Feinwachs answer that. It is not my intention to have a different standard for the hospitals as far as this particular section.
Mr. Chair. Point of order. State your point of order.
What is the policy about members passing out names, flyers signed with their names on them?
Just a second. Okay. Representative Abler, we have no problem with this. Go right ahead.
Mr. Chair, I was told that they were going to stop passing out a letter from the chamber, and I object.
Representative Abler, the letter is being passed out. Representative Boudreau, go right.
This letter?
Okay. To the chair, Representative Boudreau.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, if Mr. Feinwachs could speak to Representative Huntley's question.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, let me attempt to address your concerns. As Representative Boudreau said, it was never the intention to exempt hospitals from the requirement of being subject to the same scrutiny as any other entity in the marketplace. The language you refer to, I believe its original intent was rather addressed at the fact that many hospitals currently have departments and indeed separated buildings now which do not require a separate license because that category of licensure is subsumed by the overall hospital license and they use the same Medicare provider number as the hospital. If they change that, obviously they would have to get a different license. That was the intent. It was only to avoid having a single entity from being required to pay multiple fees for the same duplicative license. That's one. Number two, I'm not sure I quite understood the 51% argument, although let me offer something. Clearly, we have heard some concerns about that, and I think we would be open to alternative ways of dealing with that. In fact, it might be more elegant to consider modifying that definition to define it as diagnostic imaging, which is incidental to another principal line of medical practice as opposed to exclusive of the majority, and we would certainly be willing to look at that. And finally, Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, your last concern, farther on about the so-called exceptions, I'm afraid that falls into the category of darned if you do and darned if you don't. As this process went forward, we heard a variety of concerns from various people about projects underway, plans already made, commitments made. So in an effort not to hamstring anything that was already in the pipeline, that list was crafted. But if you have concerns, we can certainly look at it.
Thank you, Rod. Our agenda says that there's a potential amendment by Representative Abler. Representative Abler, do you have something to forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If discussion is done for now, I'd like to offer an amendment. There is given the short time frame that was offered to us to work on amendments, about a half hour from when the delete all was released, I did this by email, and I need to make an amendment to the amendment, if I may. It was meant to be a delete all. But hearing the debate, I think we should keep part of the bill, and I would like to, if Mr. Chun will assist me in Amendment A2.
Okay.
And just because it, you know, it's my desire that we would retain Sections 5, 6, 11, 14, 20, 26, 27, and 29, and I can speak to the amendment after the whatever technical correction that has to be made to allow it to be in the order the author would like.
Sure. Representative Abler, the committee does have a 24-hour rule on these amendments. When did this amendment get offered?
Mr. Chair, it was to the committee before noon on Friday.
and it was in this form here.
Mr. Chair, it's been a custom of this committee to be somewhat collaborative. We just faced the committee administrator was given a letter from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce before the hearing, refused to pass it out. And so I had one copy, signed my name on it, and that same chair and administrator attempted to stop it from being passed out. We have a process that's amenable, and Mr. Chair, I have the floor. We have a process that's amenable.
Representative Abel, just a moment. On the letter, it was something that hadn't been seen by the committee administrator. We did not intend, the chair did not intend to delay or prevent any distribution of letters to the committee.
Mr. Chair, then if you prefer, I'll go section by section, moving to delete sections individually if you prefer. It seems to me that in the interest of time, those amendments are always in order. And in the interest of time, it seems we could offer a single amendment. I could discuss it. If the chair would prefer, you can go either way.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Boudreau.
I would just like to, if I may, add a couple of comments. I understand that there has been some suggestions by some entities that testified today about removing Section 10, and but I don't know that there's been a consensus about removing any other particular sections. And at this point, I would like to just make a commitment to the committee. I would like to make a commitment that should this bill pass out of this committee and move to the Finance Committee, that I will work together with at least Mayo Systems and other entities. I'm not opposed to working with other entities, but it was their suggestion to remove Section 10. I have concerns about removing the whole section because I do feel there needs to be some ability for the department to either approve or deny license. And by removing that section, it would remove all of that language as well. So I will make a commitment that I will work with the committee and work with other entities to try to come up with some agreeable language for Section 10. But as far as the other parts and components of the bill, to delete them at this point, I think, would be defeat the purpose of assuring that we have some kind of standards, safety standards, reporting requirements. I have some concerns about disclosure not being upfront, and I know there was a testifier here that did say that they tell their patients about their interests, but if you look at the handout that was provided, it's not very big. It's pretty little. And I would be very concerned about removing any of that section in the bill. I'm not sure what Representative Abler wants to remove. It just says that a particular center is owned and operated as a joint venture of Allina Healthcare and Summit Orthopedics, LTD. So I don't know that that is really a sufficient thing for people to see. And I know that's a sub-issue, but it's an important issue. And I think I did consult the Attorney General's office on these issues because I am worried and concerned that patients are not receiving adequate information about disclosure, about remuneration that could be provided to providers or physicians. And I do have some information about the enforcement of that based on state enforcement and federal enforcement. And I can tell you the federal enforcement is much more forthcoming. Our state enforcement does not seem to be as adequate as can be. So I think that plays into this whole bill, maybe not significantly. But I am very concerned about deleting portions of this bill at this time, Mr. Chairman, without removing some very key parts of the bill.
Representative Abler, pursuant to the rules of the committee, the chair finds that this motion is out of order, the amendment to the amendment, on the grounds that it constitutes the violation of the 24-hour rule, which requires notice to the chair of substantive amendments.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Abler.
Representative Bradley wants to talk. I'll defer to Representative Bradley.
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to move an appeal, but I would remind the chair that the delete all amendment, I was here on Friday when it was, or Thursday night and Friday when it was finally made available. And this is a case when if somebody in doing their work tried desperately, as I know Representative Abler did try to do, it was almost impossible to meet the deadline. Now, I mean, I think we try to have a fair, open process, but I really am disappointed with the ruling of the chair. we've had a custom and usage here to say if there's consensus in the group of being willing to hear the amendment, we've allowed them to happen, and you did not present that option. Now, I'm not saying whether I agree or disagree with the amendment. That's not my issue. My issue really is, frankly, one where this is very complicated, very controversial, and certainly highly contested issues that are coming before us that are going to have very long-standing effect, very long-standing effect. And it deserves the opportunity for this committee to have thoughtful debate, thoughtful discussion. I think it's been a bit rushed in its process here toward the end. Now, as I said, I don't know whether I could support the Abler Amendment or not, but it seems to me that we're being a little heavy-handed in an area where there wasn't a whole lot of time allowed. I'll think about it from here.
Representative Boudreau, do you have any advice for the chair?
Mr. Chairman, I think the committee should make that decision about whether or not the amendment should come forward. I think we've typically done that, and I'm certainly open to that. But, you know, I understand that, you know, you've taken a position, but I have no objection to having the committee make that decision, nor bringing forth a vote on the amendment.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may add some little bit additional. I think before you go back to reconsider, I think it would be good for us to have a little bit more debate and discussion. I'm not sure that all the issues have been put on the table and we were jumping to an amendment which may or may not solve the concerns of the members, but I think a little further discussion would be in order.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, members, just to follow up on Representative Bradley saying, I agree. With 10 minutes left to try to go through Representative Abler's amendment, an oral amendment that he's going to offer, I think is it's a bit late. And quite frankly, I think that this whole issue, the bill seems to me to be flawed. I think there's been misinformation that's been provided to this member as well as other members. And quite frankly, I think we should just vote the whole bill down and have the Minnesota Hospital Association and the MMA sit down with Representative Boudreau, and if there's a way to fix this and provide the kind of regulation that she's asking for, then I think we should do it. But I think we should just vote the whole thing down, and I would hope that the members would follow that advice.
Mr. Chair?
I will, at the advice of the members who have spoken, I will reconsider my motion will your amendment to the amendment out of order? And would you like to talk about
Mr. Chair, just to explain it, and then we can decide how you want to proceed in terms of time. I just want members to understand what I was attempting to do with my amendment. I listened carefully to testimony. I listened to anybody who came near me in the last several days to talk about this. There's a consensus on HIV. There's a consensus on the Patient Bill of Rights. There's a consensus on price reporting. There's a consensus on adverse reporting. There's a consensus on Medicaid and Medicare. The amendment that I was attempting to bring forward would have preserved those sections of the bill plus some definitions to enable those to go forward, as well as the construction of a working group, which would then have reported back in January. It would be my idea, since this will take some time, and to discuss the very issues that we're about. It's my sincere conviction that there is a problem. I don't know what it is, and I don't know how to fix it if we don't know what it is, but I think the groups that are stakeholders here, seeing the pressure the legislature has put on them, would feel inclined to go talk. Each side has said the other one wouldn't talk to them, so I don't know who's, maybe they wouldn't, but now we could make them talk. And under the wise leadership of the Department of Health Commissioner and other people who are very interested in this, this working group would bring back some recommendations to address the very issues we've heard about today while preserving the good without causing undue harm. As you recall, Hippocratic Oath that we're all physicians are under is above all do no harm, and I'm concerned that this would go forward. So that's my thought behind the amendment, and you may proceed with it as you would like, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler, is there a motion? Do you want to restate your motion?
I would make a motion. I would move the. If the committee wants to talk about it more, I don't know that. But if you're doing this part, I'll move the amendment, and then you can take discussion on the amendment if you'd like. I move the amendment as amended.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Well,
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Boudreau.
I'm not sure what the amendment all entails other than what Representative Abler stated. I don't know if it includes the financial disclosure component.
Madam Chair. That's a matter that I think is very complex, and I don't know if it's resolved as simply as the type of typeface on a brochure. And I think the matters of dealing with Stark laws and such is a matter that's far beyond the scope of the committee with 3 minutes left, or that was actually over time, I believe. But I think that the working group could sit down with that topic and bring in some people who understand it and would, maybe Mr. Opatz would be part of that committee.
Mr. Chairman, I would oppose the amendment.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, point of order.
Representative Opatz, state your point of order.
I'm just terribly confused here. I have an A2 amendment that I think is the Abler amendment. Is there an amendment to this amendment that we're talking about? Because I haven't heard that other than reference to it.
Right. That's what we were just discussing. Representative Abler, would you repeat your amendment to the amendment?
If I could defer
to the A2 amendment.
Mr. Chun would repeat. I talked to staff ahead of time, so this wasn't just unwilling-nilly. I came to the meeting prepared to discuss this, and the time was very short, as my good colleagues have pointed out. So if Mr. Chun could comment on my amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, I believe that Representative Abler would like to add the following line to the A2 amendment. It would be after line 2 of the amendment. You would, add delete sections 1 to 4, 7 to 10, 12, 13, 15 to 19, 21 to 25, and 28.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I mean, as Representative Abler, are you expecting us now to read all those sections and decide now in 7 minutes whether we agree with your amendment?
Yes.
Personally?
Representative Abler?
Mr. Chair, my entire point of this amendment is it's a very sincere amendment. I attempt to preserve the good without causing harm. This is I agree with Representative Bradley, this is a very broad topic and has been brought forward in a very short time. It suffered a substantial change on Friday that was not widely disseminated until today. And so I think Representative Paymar brings forward the challenge that we all go. I believe if the body would approve the amendment as approved, they would find that they approved something they'd like, but they might want to read it first. But the substance is that it would create a working group to discuss this matter further and bring back a report. If you can vote on that today or not, I don't know, Mr. Paymar.
Representative Boudreau, what would be your advice on recessing and coming back 30 minutes after a session this afternoon?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not opposed to doing that. I'm just not sure if there's conflicting schedules for members. I think there is for me.
Yeah. Representative Boudreau, apparently I'm being told that we do have this room reserved.
Mr. Chairman, what time would that be?
4:30. Approximately 4:30.
I should ask how many people will come.
And with that, any advice, Representative Bradley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a conflict for myself personally. I don't know if that's just one person.
It's two.
I want to ask at least Representative Boudreau a question. This may be, if I were the chair, I'd probably rule me out of order, but let me try.
Mr. Bradley, we are on an amendment to an amendment.
Yeah. I do have, actually, it's a recommendation to that as an alternative, and so it is perhaps relevant in that respect. I think the section that is most troublesome is Section 10, and I think it needs work. And one way to sort of assure there's work on it, if we're really going to try to get it through, because I think the alternative that Representative Abel is presenting is sort of slow it down to study. I mean, that's basically the net. And I, with all respect to the chair, who I think wants better action, that I respect that, and there's sections that I do support in this bill. I'm wondered about the alternative in this committee to remove Section 10, with the promise being that in the Finance Committee, the work that would be going on that Representative Boudreau has promised would then have to bring it back. Now, I mean, we can either sort of leave it in, but I think it forces the issue. I mean, at least I'm desperately trying here to maintain the things I think where there's good basis for. But Section 10, I think, for a lot of the reasons that Representative Huntley mentioned, are troubling to me. So it is in the form of suggesting a different kind of action, which would be withdrawal of the amendment, and it's an alternative to deal with Section 10. But it's an idea tried on.
Mm-hmm. Representative Abler, on that basis, would you withdraw your motion?
Mr. Chair, I have concerns with a number of I'll tell you the process of the bill. The bill came out, I was an author to start with. I thought it made some sense conceptually, which is how I sign on many bills. Upon further review and hearing advice from people, I had discovered that it had some holes in it. The second draft that came out had even bigger holes in it. And some of those involved, I asked the authors if they had imported this disclosure language from any particular source, and it had been kind of drafted to suit this bill. And some of this bill needs some more work in many areas, and I don't know if removing one section would give enough pressure to people to work on the other areas as well. I don't know. I trust my Representative Boudreau immensely. However, I do not trust the process this bill has gone through today. I'm deeply wounded that we had discussed passing a letter out that was in the hand of the committee administrator before the hearing. And if that's the process this bill is going to go, then I'll sit here until tomorrow and talk about some of the details. I've left some. Wilkin hasn't offered a word of thought. I know he has thoughts. Many members have other thoughts, and I think that I think many of the policy members, Representative Paymar and Representative Opatz and other members of the policy committee, need a chance to discuss the policy of this. And I don't think that it should be advancing beyond today if we can't have a good, thorough discussion. This is big policy, Mr. Chair, and I'm not intending to filibuster it. The testimony took over an hour and a half. And so I think we all deserve a chance to say our thoughts and to work on it. Perhaps if the bill will be continued to another day, that we all could come in and even stay late one night and work on it, I'll help work on it. But I don't know that that the members of the policy committee should be left out of that discussion that don't serve on finance. So I think it'd be my suggestion that my amendments out there, people know where the consensus. I think I've got a consensus at my point. If you can get a bigger consensus than go beyond there, that'd be my advice. And I won't withdraw the amendment.
Any further discussion on Representative Abler's A2 amendment as amended?
Mr. Chair, another point of order here.
Representative Opat.
Mr. Chair, did we just incorporated his amendment to the amendment? It's now in his amendment?
It has not been adopted.
Okay, so we are not voting on his amendment. We're voting
on the amendment.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Thanks for the clarification, Representative Boudreau.
I would just encourage members to vote against the Abler amendment, and I'm very willing to consider Representative Bradley's suggestion of dropping Section 10, even though I made a commitment to you that I would be working on that just as a forewarning. I would oppose this amendment.
Further discussion on Representative Abler's amendment to his A2 amendment. Those in favor all signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no.
No.
No. Opinion of the chair, the amendment fails.
Division. Amendment.
The
working group? I asked for a division, Mr. Chair.
Division being called for. All those in favor of the amendment to the amendment, signify by raising your hand. Okay. Those opposed, signify by raising your hand.
His ears work good, Mr. Chair.
Amendment fails 13-4. Back to your original A2 amendment, Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, at least there's some way to talk about this, if this can go forward and then there can be some feedback mechanism. So.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Opatz, yes.
I am of a similar mind as Representative Huntley and Bradley on Section 10 and where we're at. Should we, those of us who would be willing to go there, do you want to dispense with this amendment first, or would this be an amendment on this, that idea be an amendment to this amendment?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Boudreau.
I move deletion of Section 10.
We have another amendment.
We do have a motion before the committee, however.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, are you?
Representative Abler.
At the committee's wish.
Is the I appreciate some discussion about the amendment. Is the committee uninterested in having a report back from a stakeholder group should this bill go forward?
Right now we are discussing your amendment A2 and trying to dispose of that before we move forward.
Mr. Chair, this has been an interesting process. I now I'll withdraw the amendment.
Representative Abler withdraws the A2 amendment. Any further discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilkin.
As the author knows, I have a number of issues with the bill, and I appreciate the elimination of Section 10, which I assume we'll do right after this. There's a number of other issues here about licensing and the need for licensure. I think we need to see from the advocates of the bill some kind of demonstration of why this is needed, other than we're licensed, we have these regulations, and we want everybody else to have them. Leveling the playing field can mean two things. It can mean regulating the heck out of everybody else, and it can also mean kind of controlling, from the state level, regulation of our hospitals. I'm glad that this section is going to get taken out, but I do think the bill has a number of other problems, and I hope those, I hope the warring factions sit down between now and the next committee and deal with those.
Representative Boudreaux, do you have, like to make a motion, renew your motion?
Mr. Chairman, if the committee would approve such a late amendment, I would like to delete Section 10.
Representative Boudreaux moves to delete Section 10. Is there discussion on that motion? To the motion of deletion of Section 10, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion passes. Chairman Boudreaux, would you...
Mr. Chairman, I would renew my motion that House File 2127 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
As amended.
As amended.
Discussion on the motion. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to make it clear as best I can. To me, it's a little unorthodox for the Finance Committee to be dealing with what may be some policy issues. I'm respectful of that. I'm respectful of Representative Boudreaux's hard work in this, but I will admit to the committee and to the public that I'm a little bit uncomfortable with doing that. And all I can say to the warring parties is you better darn well show some good faith work. This chair is not going to tolerate this bill coming before us without there having been good faith work on both sides. And Representative Boudreaux and I have talked about it. I believe she agrees with me on that count. I will try to be as fair as possible. I realize that not every person sitting at the table today is a member of the Finance Committee, but I'm trying to honor, I think, the wishes of the author, but also I want to make it very clear to the parties involved that there had better be some really good work before it comes to the Finance Committee, because we're not going to hear it pending deadlines, but we're not going to hear it unless I'm really satisfied. That's the best I can do.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of House File 2127, the DE1 amendment as amended by committee, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed?
No. No.
The ayes have it.
Division.
Those in favor of the amendment, the DE1 amendment, the passage of the bill referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee, all signify by raising their hands. Those opposed? Thirteen to four.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the extra time.
Thank the members of the committee, and next meeting will be at Wednesday at 8:15. Committee stands adjourned.
The committee will come to order. I want to thank everybody for getting here. We're going to be doing a couple of things today. There's two main orders of business in terms of at least topics. We're going to finish up our work on the Emergency Health Powers of Reauthorization Act of 2004. If the Department of Health wants to come down to get ready for that, that would be a good idea. And then when we finish that, we're going to finish our work on the MDH licensing bill, which has got much larger than it did when it left the garage originally from the Department of Health, and then sometimes things do that. You can read the agenda.
Yes.
Okay, good. All righty. And it's our intention to act on both these bills and move them to the full committee, and we'll give due discussion to whatever has to be discussed. And I'm informed that if we finish today, which we darn well better, we'll be hearing both these bills and HHS policy on Monday, March 8th at 12:30 or thereabouts. And it's just, you know, if as this goes along, if you have some thoughts about what's in the bills or any great changes you want to make, I suggest you do that with me in the meantime, because it was the intention to hear most of the matters of these two large projects at this level. Not that you can't act on them later, but they'll be relatively heard relatively briefly at the full committee level. Anyway, so with that, I'd like to move House Stall 2436 to be passed and be referred to the full committee. And I'd like to move Amendment DE1. And is Amendment A2 drafted to DE1? And let's vote on that. That'll put the bill in order that's half ready. So all in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. And then there's an Amendment A2, which I'd like to move to put the bill in the final order that we want it to be in. And we'll discuss these matters before we vote on passing it up. Any questions about A2? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, welcome, Department of Health. I want to commend the Department of Health. They haven't always been their strongest supporter, but on this matter, they've been great. And I've, my sixth year, and it's to me, it's better to work with someone than to work against them, and I want to commend them for their very open mind on this topic and their consideration of almost every concern I had. And so what you see, I think, is a bill that that brings in almost all the ideas that we heard from almost all the groups that brought forward specific concerns were addressed in the bill, except in the amendments that you'll see, short of why we're doing it anyway. We weren't going to take up that question because we have the issue of SARS and other future bad diseases that are going to come upon us, and we have concerns about terrorism. And I think as the department goes through, I think if you brought concerns, you'll see that they were taken into consideration. You might even see a whole idea in that, which I think is the best way to craft a piece of legislation, as broad-ranging, as important as this. So thank you, Ms. Lighthizer. Would you like to tell us what you've been working on in the last week?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Aggie Lighthizer. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health. And we have been doing a lot of incorporating of the ideas that we heard last week, and you'll see a lot of that here. And it may be a little complicated as we work both with the DE1 and the A2 amendment, and I'll try to be clear about where we're at. Starting then with the A2 amendment, the first change is in Section 1. We've added some additional language that says that a licensed healthcare facility would only be used commandeered or procured by the government when other alternatives are not feasible during a public health emergency. That was a concern that we heard from the nursing home industry. Then moving back to the DE1, another issue that we heard, I think from the Family Council, the concern about that people ought to have the ability to have the information before they make a decision about whether or not they refuse or decide to take an examination, testing, or treatment. So we are deleting line 5, the where feasible. Then the next change is the description and the definition of emergency plan. We had again heard some concern about maybe there'd be some facilities that would join together to write a plan, and so we've modified that so that it would be a public health plan, a plan by one or more healthcare facilities, and then any provision we have for inter or intrastate compacts. The next change is the DE1, page 2, subdivision 6. The definition of a public health emergency responder. There were a number of groups that wanted to be included in this list. We've included certified nursing assistant and other applicable staff positions within healthcare provider organizations. We've added mental health professionals. And there's additional language around first responder, which you will see on amendment A2, page 2, some additional language about that they may be registered or not registered, but they would need to be responding as part of a dispatching event. The next definition change is for volunteer. We've deleted the OR organization. Again, some concern that we were not being consistent, and we've cleaned that part up. We've also added that the compensation would not necessarily be from state or local government. They may get paid and are sent by their employer to assist, so they may still get paid, but not by state or local government. Another change, because of something that we missed in putting this together, is that the workers' compensation issue needs to go to the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council. So we're deleting reference to workers' compensation on the Delete Everything Amendment, Section 3. So it's only addressing now liability protection. Some changes also to the responder included some redrafting of the wording for on page 3 of the Delete Everything Amendment. The subdivision number 3 acts within the scope or duties approved by the local government or the state, and included language and within the volunteer's limits of training and skill, so they would not be doing things that would fall beyond that capacity. The next change is in Section 4 related to tort action against a volunteer. In the A2 amendment, we clarified that the occurrence limit, that was a discussion from the committee last week, the single occurrence limit applies to the volunteer's action, not to the entire public health emergency. There was some discussion about regional hospital system, and one of the things that we've done on Section 5 is add in definition of the regional hospital system, and then indicated in the amendment that it's available on the web, and we do have a distribution of hospitals, so it's the, how the hospitals within a region. There's also some concern about how long does the liability for the Good Samaritan event act, and we rearranged some of the wording and clarified that the Good Samaritan liability provisions would only apply during the period of the emergency executive order. If there are events that happen after that emergency order is done, then you'd revert to usual and customary events. The next change is on page 4 of the Delete Everything Amendment. The in response to some concerns from some from the Dental Association in particular and some others, there's some language on lines 32 to 36 around that there would not be administrative penalties or professional discipline or other actions as a result of assisting in vaccination clinics. The next change is related to the security data information. We've, in response again to some questions and concerns, tightened that up on page 5, line 12, so that it refers to only data used to assisting in preparedness or response to an emergency, and it was much broader before we added in that restriction. The next change is on page 7 of the Delete Everything Amendment, and the A2 amendments on the bottom of page 2, One of the questions was about the amount of force that a police officer or a peace officer shall use to enforce a commissioner or court order, and we are using language that says they should use reasonable order but not deadly reasonable force but not deadly force. And we cleaned up some language about how the peace officer under what conditions he can act upon or she can act upon the court order, and clarified that the information about infection control practitioners would be from the public health sector, so we can have some approach to consistency across the state. That same language applies to the court order language as well. The next change is on the Delete Everything Amendment, page 11, and it's around the employee protection issues. And this, again, you'd need to go to the A2 amendment. We've tightened up the definition or the description of when a person would be eligible for some job protection or some employment protection. The person would need to be under a temporary hold order from the commissioner, an order of a federal quarantine officer, a state or federal court order, or a written recommendation of the commissioner or designee, and they must also be part of a monitoring program so that it is a real program that's related to the communicable diseases. So I think we tried to tighten that up in response to concerns about that this was way too broad. We also added in some language to clarify that our expectation is that this would not last longer than 21 consecutive days. And then there is one subdivision on the Delete Everything Amendment that the department is not supportive of, that subdivision 4 about small businesses. And then finally on page 11 of the Delete Everything Amendment is the referral to the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council to review the Tort Protection and Workers' Compensation to Volunteers proposal. The last thing on the A2 amendment is, do you want me to talk about that now, Mr. Chair? The health study?
Please, just finish up, yeah.
Okay. The language that we've worked on with the local public health association representing public health agencies across the state about evaluating a public health data management system and coming back to the legislature in January with a report on what that might include and what how we might get started on such a thing. Mr. Chair, that's the review.
Thank you. There's a lot of topics there, and as you, they go kind of fast as you whip through them, but there's been a lot of discussion, a lot of work done to get these paragraphs in such agreed form as they're at. So any members, any questions from members? There's a technical amendment we need to move while you think about your questions. On, and some eagle eye of a good lobbyist in the audience spotted this, so it had been an original draft, and we just had so many papers it just got lost. On page 2, well, maybe I'll let Ms. Benelli explain the amendment, then I'll move the amendment that Ms. Benelli will describe.
Mr. Chair, this is a technical amendment to conform to other changes within A2. Page 2, line 32, delete workers' compensation. Page 2, line 33, delete coverage.
And members, what this is doing is it's we had some workers' comp coverage for volunteers, and we decided in the interest of keeping the systems intact the state already has, that we let the Work Comp Advisory Council address this topic and bring us back some advice. You'll probably hear this discussed later when we get to Commerce in a different round. But anyway, so any questions about the amendment? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All righty. Any questions from members about the substance of the bill? Let's see. Are we done? Thank you. Is anybody in the audience that wishes to testify about the bill as amended? This is your chance. I think you're dismissed for now. I'll ask again. Is anybody who didn't hear me say that 30 seconds ago, just so you know, just by contrast, this bill is a little more controversial 2 years ago, if anybody was watching. I do want to thank the public health people who are in the audience waiting to address concerns, and they've been very good to work with, especially certain ones who I, anyway, thank you. And other people, too, have weighed in, and I think this is how a bill ought to be done, if we can. So, any, Representative Tao has a question.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, you asked me earlier whether I have any comments on this. I think it's
it's a pretty standard. It's a good bill. I don't think the government is out to do anything bad to anyone. So I would recommend we pass this.
Okay. That could be the final word. Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the motion to recommend it to pass and be sent to the full committee and then on its way, say aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you. The motion prevails. The bill is passed on. The next bill on our calendar for the day, thank you very much, and thank you, Department of Health, and all the other good people that helped out this to go so well. The next bill on our calendar is House File 2175. And if you've, I think there's seven articles in this bill now, which I think is pretty cool to have a seven-article bill. If you've been following your piece of legislation through, I would suggest that you take it upon yourself now to edit your little piece to make sure it's how it should be. We will have some technical changes along the way, I'm sure. I already have one. Oh, spare one. Anyway, so I would move I'll move House File 2175 be recommended to pass and be referred to the full committee. And now I'll move H2175DE1. And members, this is simply the composite of all the work we did last time on all the topics we heard. I believe there were nine different topics addressed, something like that anyway. And this is simply the composite of all the language that we did. There were still a couple outlying issues we have to deal with, which we're going to deal with pretty soon here. Any questions about the DE1?
Mm-hmm.
It's bigger.
Yeah.
It's exactly the same size. It's an addition. If you add all the bills together, you get this. So there's no changes to my knowledge to what we heard last time. So any questions? All in favor of this putting a DE1 on the bill, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, and now what we're going to do is we're going to invite the people from CLUS up to the table. And then what we'll do is we're going to take up, we have two groups that we have to hear from. One is the podiatrists have to talk, and we have to hear from the dentist. The podiatrist and the MD has got to get together on something, and we have to hear from the, the dentist and the hygienist have to get together on something, and we'll hear from them soon. Anyway, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and tell us about your most worthy project.
Okay. Well, first of all, Representative Abler and subcommittee members, I want to thank you for inviting us to testify on behalf of our bill today. My name is Maureen Acosta, and I'm the Director of Fund Development and Communications for Chicanos, Latinos Unidos, and Servicio, otherwise known as CLUS. I'm going to give you an extremely brief overview of CLUS. I have given your committee staff copies of our most recent annual report, which gives more details. Then I'm going to turn it over to Kevin Spading, who's our Director of Mental and Chemical Health Services, to talk more specifically as to why we are seeking designation as an essential community provider. CLUS was established in 1981 by a group of Latino mental health workers who saw the need for linguistically appropriate and culturally competent mental health services for primarily Spanish-speaking Latinos. Today, CLUS is one of the largest and leading providers of linguistically appropriate services, including behavioral services, for Latinos in the state of Minnesota. In fact, we are the largest Latino social services agencies in Minnesota. We provide five core services: mental health, chemical health, education, employment, and elder wellness. We have two offices in Minnesota, in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Though we primarily serve Latinos in the Twin City metro area, we do have Latinos coming to CLUS from all over the state of Minnesota. At this point, I don't know if you have any questions, but at this point I would like to turn it over to Kevin to speak more specifically as to why we're seeking designation.
Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Welcome.
Go ahead. Again, I direct the Chemical and Mental Health Services.
Just tell us your name and for the tape. So.
Kevin Spading, and I'm the Director of Chemical and Mental Health Services. We're here to help the capacity of behavioral health services grow in Minnesota, and essential community provider status allows that kind of sustainability. And so encouraged by some of the third-party organizations such as UVH and Portico, there are a couple of examples of letters of support indicating their desire to have more providers in the community. This status and this application process gives us the chance to become reimbursed as an essential community provider. We do have state, we do have licensed entities at CLUS, such as in our Elder Wellness, and we invited one of our families to come and, if available or needed, testify to the benefits of an organization like CLUS. But primarily helps the behavioral health, the combination of both chemical and mental health services, to be valued by those third-party organizations.
Thank you. Ms. Acosta, do they want to say hello to us since they've come?
Yes.
Yeah, that'd be nice. Let them come forward, and then they can tell us their name, and you can interpret for them, or they can talk however they like. So, good. Is it? Muy bienvenidos. I'm quitting while I'm ahead.
We brought over one of our staff members to serve, who works with them to serve as the interpreter. And Corey, would you introduce yourself?
My name is Corey Bruno. I'm the program coordinator for the Elderly Wellness Program. And I'd like to introduce you to Maria Correa and Alfredo Correa.
Si quieren decirle, habla.
Hello.
Hello. Mi nombre es María Correa.
My name is María Correa.
Me siento muy complacida de estar aquí, que me hayan invitado a esta reunión.
She's glad to be here at this meeting.
Soy miembro de los seniors de CLUS.
She's a member of the seniors group at CLUS.
Les estoy muy agradecida y muchas thank yous.
Thank you.
Por nada.
Do you have any questions for either of them?
Members, do you have any questions? Thank you very much for coming. It's our pleasure. And members, I think you're pretty well aware of the ECP program, but it allows all the plans to cover the services that are done at these particular sites. So if they are covered, they're covered. If they have any coverage, the coverage works there. So. And so, Anna, do you have we're going to move the inclusion of House File 1920, but we have to make it in the form of an amendment. And so, Ms. Minnelli, what do we have to change about that? Do you want, should we take that up later, or are you ready to go with that now?
Mr. Chair, on page 62 of the DE1 amendment, after line 29, we're going to insert in Article 9, and the bill would be inserted as new language in Article 9.
And I'll move that amendment, and that would incorporate the language of House File 1920 into the omnibus.
And, Mr. Chair, could you direct staff to make any technical changes?
Would you please make technical changes and whatever else you think we need to add to make it comply with the wishes of the committee? Any questions about that, members? Any questions for the about the topic? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. You're good to go. Thanks very much for coming down. It's all set.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Speaking of all set, if the podiatrists and et al. Would like to come down and tell us how good their work has been going. We're going to revert to two different pieces of this bill, and at that point, if I forgot anything, you'll need to let me know, but I think that's the two things we have to do yet. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Renner gets to testify today? Oh, he's going to sit there. Sit down at the table, Mr. Renner. It's good to have you at the table.
I frightened him away.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. We have an amendment which we just scribbled over, and we've given it to council
that we've agreed on at this point. And what it does is it affects the history and physical section of the bill, where podiatric medicine includes podiatrists performing histories and physicals. And the amendment clarifies that if the patient has a condition or disease that is outside the scope of practice of podiatric medicine, that then the patient will be referred to a medical doctor for a diagnosis.
I'd read it.
And that's the substance of the amendment.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Dave Benhurst, representing
Mr. Renner,
medical
welcome
association.
To the committee.
As Ms. Barrett has indicated, our concern initially, first of all, I appreciate the podiatrists that shared the bill with us and did try to get our input on a couple of areas, which we did share with our membership. The one area that there was some concern was over the issue of histories and physicals. Histories and physicals, for those that are just to make sure everyone's aware, prior to any kind of a procedure in a hospital or a surgical center or elsewhere, required under a number of different requirements for both hospital credentialing but also Medicare and others to have a history and physical, a pre-op physical. And many times this is related to how you will react in the surgery, how you will react to anesthesia and other things. The one concern is not questioning the training of podiatrists in their area of expertise in surgery, but we're trying to address what happens if you have a patient who has multiple conditions, a patient who may also have heart condition, a patient who may also have other conditions that would have impact on that, and we felt our concern was that in those situations we felt the physician should be involved in that. The language we've tried to put forward tries to clarify that provision. So if it's a situation with a relatively healthy patient doing potentially a more minor procedure, the podiatrist will be able to do that history and physical. If it has more complications, more interactions, those types of things, we think that the physician would be involved with that one.
Mr. Chair, just to add, our intent is not for podiatric physicians to perform preoperative clearance on a routine basis, but there are situations that arise, for instance, with a diabetic patient who presents to an outpatient clinic and requires emergent incision and drainage procedures. These patients are oftentimes medically stable, yet they need an emergency surgery, and that would be a situation in which a podiatric physician would perform a history and physical, barring some other major medical illness that would affect their ability to do surgery without a referral to a physician.
Did you want to speak?
Just
we have a little thing going back and forth
here.
Mr. Renner,
Chair.
Any more thoughts?
Again, as we are just scribbling this in the hallways, I think both of us, at least I speak for myself, I don't want to speak for Ms. Barrett, we are making a commitment to try to keep trying to work on this. If this wording isn't quite right, we will want to have some further discussions. But we are at least trying to work out something and keep this moving.
Mr. Renner, I just have to interrogate you a little bit. and the language that will be read to us in a moment by Ms. Benelli, the only world's copy of this, so let's guard that carefully. This is not quite where you hope it is, but it's close to where you hope to wind up?
Mr. Chair, members, I think that's accurate. I think this is moving in the right direction. There is another issue that has come up over, it's more of a procedural issue related to hospital privileges that we have committed that we still need to have some further discussions on. But the concept that we're moving forward in is that in certain situations where there's not a lot of complications, a relatively healthy patient, and it's podiatric surgery, that a podiatrist would be able to do that history and physical. If it's a situation where there would be more complications, potentially more interactions, drug interactions, that would still have a physician involved.
And Ms. Barrett, you think you're about 90% there? Is that your sense of this amendment that this it will be visiting this a little later, I would guess. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, thank you. I question. Actually, why don't you read this amendment, Ms. Benelli, so we can know what we're talking about?
This is an amendment to the Delete Everything Amendment, Mr. Chair. DE1, page 56, line 21, before the period, insert, unless the patient has a disease or condition that requires treatment that is beyond the practice of podiatric medicine permitted by law, then the licensed podiatric physician shall promptly advise that patient to seek evaluation by an appropriate licensed physician for completion of the medical history and physical examination.
Does that sound like what you agreed to?
That is correct.
Thank you, Ms. Mayor. Mr. Representative Tao will move that amendment. Just to get his name in the minutes. And any questions about that? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. There'll be somebody voting for it. Opposed, the same sign. The amendment is adopted. The bill is amended. And thank you for continuing to work on that, and I appreciate the way you can collaborate there. Thank you.
Thank you for your assistance.
Okay, Mr. Schrag and your colleague there. Hi, welcome back.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
And you were sent off to do a project, and Mr. Schrag and your associate there. And is there a language in front of us that, tell us what you've come up with?
We did go back with the responsibility of trying to come to some agreement on language that we had disagreed on last week. I passed out through Jason the proposal that I've drafted to amend the amendment, and there are actually four areas in the bill that we wish to refine the language on, one of which we talked about last week, which was the language regarding the accreditation for dental hygiene programs and institutions. So you do have language that is in front of you, hopefully, now that that is being proposed. And I also propose an amendment to that amendment because Ms. Hazen pointed out that I had inconsistent language in there from what we described previously. What I've handed out, unfortunately, is not what you're accustomed to. It's not in the appropriate format. What I've done is simply put together the language as we wish it to read. Not you don't have the language as it was or as it currently is with the crossouts. So, if I may, how would you like me, Mr. Chair, to refer to our recommended?
Just a minute, Mr. Schrag. Ms. Benelli, do you feel like you can comprehend what our intent will be, or do you want us to give you some time to work on this?
And I'm able to refer to the lines of the amended bill, the 2175.
Just to make sure our staff can. It's less important that I understand every word, but that staff does, because they'll be writing this up later.
Appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, I think as long as you give staff direction to amend the bill or amend the technical changes properly later, then I think it should be fine.
Okay, Mr. Schrag, why don't you describe, and do you want to say hello, Ms. Hazen? Do you want to?
Thank you very much, Mr. Yeah. Chair.
And so this is language that the two of you have agreed to, and you're at a consensus, and everybody's happy, and will we be revisiting this somewhere along the line, or is this going to be the agreement we're going to work with?
This is Candy Hazen with the Minnesota Dental Hygienists Association, and we have agreed with the changes that Mr. Schrag has made. We are dropping the second part of the amendment that we had introduced last week, and we're just going to go with the language that he has recommended here with the addition of the change that we've discussed earlier.
That you have.
So do you want to describe then what the specifics are, Mr. Schrag?
Yes, the language should read as presented: a person of good moral character who has graduated from a dental hygiene program accredited by the Commission on Dental Accreditation. At that point, we would like to add of the American Dental Association, so that would be consistent with other language in the bill. And established in an institution accredited by an agency recognized by the United States Department of Education to offer college-level programs. United States Department of Education to offer college-level programs may apply for licensure. The program must provide a minimum of 2 academic years of dental hygiene education, etc. The reason that the Dental Hygiene Association had proposed going back to the original language that we had in the bill was because they've distinguished between programs that are accredited by the Commission on Dental Accreditation and institutions that are accredited through a different means, and wanted recognition of the institutions being accredited as well. And so we've revised this so that both the board and the association are comfortable with the change.
And any questions, members? Santel, you want to be their friend hygienist today and move this amendment?
Yeah, it looks like everyone agreed on it.
Yeah, and you want to... And you want to advise the staff to do what it takes to make this look like what it looks like? Okay.
I would advise the staff to make it look like what it's supposed to look like.
Anyway, any discussion? Anybody in the audience have a thought about this? Thank goodness. But you could have had a thought. It's okay. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the amendment, Representative Howell's amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Well, you got two amendments on today.
Ask them.
The motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Let's see. You're free to go.
Did you want me to describe the other amendments to that bill as well, so that those can also be introduced into?
I think that your language has already been into the delete all. So if you wanted to talk about it, is there something else?
What I passed out today was not. It didn't exist until about an hour ago.
Oh,
so.
Oh, that was the hygienist part. Did we do
right?
So did we? We just did the hygienist thing. Is there something else beyond the hygienist?
There is, with just regard to clarifying some of the language, and that refers to on your amended bill 2175, page 42, lines 32 to 35, and it's also on the same handout as the hygiene language. And have you located that?
If you could repeat what page you're trying to work on.
I believe on your amended bill, it's page 42, lines 32 through 35.
Oh, so your amendment is based upon your bill. I understand. So I got you. So we're on page 42, lines 32 to 35. And so you're tweaking up your... Okay, is this the Gerlach bill?
No. And this has to do with specialty licensure for dentists applying for a license as a specialist, and clarifies language in there that had been unclear previously.
Okay.
The issue was that the language that we had submitted previously that you see on line 34 of page 42 indicated that somebody had to have taken an exam in another state that required, not that they had ever practiced in a state that required an exam. And so the revised language proposes that the person actually have practiced in a state requiring a clinical exam.
Ms. Benelli, following over our here, there's a paragraph B that I'm unable to find. I'm sorry if I'm a little dull today here.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Schrag, is your on line 42 of the delete all, you're saying there's a paragraph B?
On page 42, I'm looking at line 32.
Oh, we're in the top part. I'm sorry. I'm on that.
I'm looking at line 32 of page 42, which is...
so we're just doing the top part of your amendment, just the line 6 to 9.
Oh, that's on this is what I'm referring to on my proposed amendment. It refers, it's...
line 6 to 9.
Line 6 through 9.
And that's all the...
That's correct.
And so you reworded the language that you had submitted before
to
be relatively in Canadian province. And is Ms. Bailey, are you comfortable with that now? Did you?
Mr. Chair, I understand. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Similarly, on my handout, what is lines 11 through 13 is substitute language proposed. That is substitute language that refers to the delete all amendment, page 44, lines 30 to 32. And that defines better for us who and when somebody is required to indicate their desire to limit their practice and apply for a specialty license.
Okay, and is there is that the end of your
No, there's one more. And that is lines on my handout, lines 22 through 30, which refers to the delete all amendment, page 49, lines 3 through 15. And the additional language in my proposal does a couple of things. One is that it makes it clear that the waiver of the clinical exam applies to somebody who has achieved either completion of a GPR, the general dentistry residency, or an AEGD program, which is a similar program. And we believe that was the intent of the bill originally, but and that's the way that we had intended to apply it. but wanted to make sure that it was clear in statute that applied to either program.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's it. That's okay. All I have for you.
Do members have questions about the substance? Actually, Mr. Schrag, just so you know, this isn't the best way to do it. You're going to get a free pass today. But you were sent out to work on hygiene stuff. And bringing back new language at the table, not telling me when I'm helping you with your bill is not the good way. It's not good government. And so we're going to adopt your amendment into the bill today, but I want, I'd like you to go talk to Mr. Spazzetto and anybody else who cares about this. Let them tell me that they're comfortable, too.
Okay. There are representatives here from the Minnesota Dental Association that we've discussed this language with that are prepared to speak to it if you wish to.
Yeah, I'm just telling you it's not a good way to do it.
I understand. I apologize.
Thank you. Is anybody in the audience who wishes to testify about this, even though they didn't have notice? Yeah. Mr. Schrag, is there any information about the fee increase fiscally? Is there a fee?
There's a fiscal increase? Note request that we got today in our office that is due, that I've got due to finance on Wednesday. And so since I just learned of that today, my intent is to provide that by Wednesday.
And those of you who have requests for fiscal notes, we need those toot suite so we can get this thing moving along. Ms. Representative Soderstrom, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Anybody wishes to testify about this? I will. This matter is, in my mind, considered a bit open just till we get through the full policy, just in the interest of how we're trying to conduct this subcommittee. Any other questions? I'll move the amendment on the behalf of Mr. Schrag. Any questions about it? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Same sign. The amendment is adopted. And that'll be... potential discussion item. What else do we have there? Is there any more topics we need to address on this bill? Oh, we do have to deal with your matter. Representative Tremba has an amendment and a witness. Has that amendment been passed out and is the witness here? Is your witness here, Mr. Representative Tremba? Yeah, what's his name? Wales? Mr. Wales, are you in the audience? Welcome to the committee, Mr. Wales. And in the, you know, the people in the audience have been through this whole process quite a while. The part of the goal of this subcommittee has been to thoroughly and properly notify people about topics that come up. This amendment that's about to offer has had no notification to the public, and so there may be some discussion along the way that may make it controversial or not. I don't know, but we're here to hear you today, and we're welcome to the committee and introduce yourself and. Tell us about your project here, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Greg Wales, president of the Minnesota Hearing Healthcare Providers. I did not intend to be out of order. I believe Representative Tremba had intended to introduce the bill. Am I correct?
Representative Tremba?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I've actually had it up, I think, for about 4 years now. Asking for a hearing, and Mr. Chair, you invited us to do this as an amendment and hoped that we would at least have some discussion about it.
So, Mr. Wales, do you want to describe the situation, Representative Tremba, and then let Mr. Wales testify, or maybe you can set the stage for us? I think that we're not informed. This hasn't been laid back to us a lot, so we're happy to hear what's on your mind. So, please tell us.
Well, basically, and Mr. Chair, it's to allow hearing aid dispensers to receive Medicare along with audiologists, and it's done in another state, and so I thought it looked like a way to save money, save health care costs, and so this was a way that we brought it forward.
Mr. Chair and Representative Tremba, excuse me, you misspoke yourself. It's Medicaid, not Medicare.
I'm sorry.
Representative Tremba.
I apologize.
We forgive you. One disadvantage, just as things come to the table at a committee, is we don't know a lot about the background. There's a lot of ins and outs. We don't know about fiscal notes.
this bill is generally meant to be a fiscally neutral bill in terms of costing or saving any money. The dollars are very small that will be involved here at any rate. Why don't you, Representative Tim, why don't you kind of set the stage for the bill and what the problem is, and or is that all you have to say?
Mr. Chair, I would prefer that the witness continue with the details.
Okay, well, Mr. Wales.
Thank you.
Please tell us about your project.
Once again, Greg Wales, and I am sorry that this was out of order. I did not intend it to be. I can set the backdrop a little bit.
No, you're not out of order. It's just that we don't know what you're here to talk about, so I'm not bursting your topics.
I didn't
go
want
ahead,
that
please.
To happen either.
Yeah, no, it's okay. Go ahead. Please tell us your story.
I'm a hearing instrument dispenser certified by the Department of Health. I am not an audiologist. The Department of Health certifies approximately, I believe, currently 390 hearing instrument dispensers in the state of Minnesota. Of those, about 220 are audiologists. The balance are hearing instrument dispensers who are not audiologists. They are like me. The Department of Human Services administers federal funds and provides hearing aids and hearing evaluations for their clients with those federal funds. Their policy is not to allow hearing instrument dispensers who have been certified by the Minnesota Department of Health as qualified to evaluate hearing for the purpose of selecting and fitting hearing aids as eligible to evaluate hearing for Department of Human Service clients. And we are asking that through this bill that the Department of Human Services be directed to recognize hearing instrument dispensers who have been certified by the Department of Health, but not audiologists. I should say, in addition to audiologists, not instead of. I phrased that incorrectly. I don't want to get the wrong impression. What I'm trying to say is that the Department of Human Services recognize hearing instrument dispensers who happen not to be audiologists, but are certified by the Department of Health as qualified to evaluate hearing for the purpose of selecting and fitting hearing aids, to be eligible to do so on Department of Human Services clients. Did I make that clear?
Yes.
What I've done in this handout, I've highlighted the only points that I believe are important, but I didn't want to present them to you out of context. Therefore, I've given you the context. And what I see as difficulties, if you look on page 1, under definitions, it addresses what an audiologic evaluation is. Up above it, it says what an audiologist is, which a audiologist is a person certified in clinical competence from the American Speech and Hearing Association, and therefore they define an audiologic evaluation as an assessment administered by an audiologist or otolaryngologist to evaluate communication problems caused by hearing loss. You can see immediate difficulty right here. If audiologic evaluations can only be performed by audiologists, then nobody else can perform an audiologic evaluation. And any word that refers, any statute or rule that refers to an audiologic evaluation implies it must be performed by an audiologist. So that's going to be a problem, and wording will have to be changed where that appears. And I've tried to identify where it appears. On page 2 on the top, it defines a hearing aid service provider. That's the type of person I am. I'm not an audiologist. I'm a person who's been certified by the Department of Health as a hearing instrument dispenser. Skip a few pages here. On to page 4. We have in the Department of Human Services HCPCS codes. They've been highlighted, beginning on the left-hand side with 92590 down to 92593. Those six codes would therefore have to apply to people that are not necessarily audiologists, but hearing instrument dispensers who are certified by the Department of Health to evaluate hearing, as are all certified hearing instrument dispensers. On the bottom of the page, I have two things highlighted, one in yellow and one in green. I can read them for the benefit of those that don't have something like this before them. It says, before providers are reimbursed for hearing aid assessments, a dispensing, a physician, I believe that should, oh, excuse me. Before providers are reimbursed for hearing aid assessments or dispensing, a physician, physician assistant, or nurse practitioner must rule out medical or surgical indications contrary to fitting the recipient with a hearing aid. This rule would still apply, that people like me would not be allowed to necessarily go out and test anybody we chose and diagnose them as needing a hearing aid and then dispensing a hearing aid to them. It would have to be under the direction of the personal physician attending that patient. That's on page 4, highlighted in yellow. And also on page 4, highlighted in green or underscored in green, an audiologist or otolaryngologist must provide the audiologic testing, and if a hearing aid is indicated, prescribe a specific hearing aid offered under the hearing aid volume purchase contract. An individual who is enrolled as a hearing aid dispenser, that's who I am, and this is current language now, but is not an audiologist or otolaryngologist, may not perform audiologic evaluations or prescribe hearing devices. So this issue has been directly addressed, and this is something that we request would be reversed. On page 5, it's worded differently, slightly. Underscored in green once again, it says, hearing aid service providers are not separately reimbursed for audiologic evaluations, hearing aid exams, and selection, hearing aid checks to determine the effectiveness of the hearing aid, or home visits. So they have, in this language here, and we're looking at Health and Human Services rules, specifically excluded people who are not audiologists from providing this evaluation. And I'd like to point out one item that I think is interesting. In the HCPCS codes that are covered where hearing instrument dispensers and audiologists are supposed to provide the service they provide is described for hearing instrument dispensers. I'm getting a little ahead of myself. It's on page 8 and 9 in those boxes. Nowhere do we see a HCPCS code that addresses something that is very common now with digital hearing aids, and that is the programming of the digital hearing aids. And on the bottom of page 6, it says that the dispensing fee covers a number of items, including what I've underscored in yellow, including the necessary programming on digital and digitally programmable hearing aids. Hearing instrument dispensers, according to the current paradigm, are dispensing the hearing aids, and they're doing the follow-up for 2 years, and it's covered under a one-time reimbursement called a fitting and dispensing fee. The hearing aids, there is no markup on the hearing aid at all. That's sold, it's handled by the hearing instrument dispenser, but it's a contract item where the manufacturer agrees with the state on the price, and we just handle the money. There's no profit that comes out of that. So one of the things that is included is the necessary programming on the digital hearing aids. And this is done by the dispenser. I didn't mean to gloss over anything. If Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, if you have other questions regarding the body of this, I'd be willing to try to answer them.
I think it's good. We do have a question. Representative Sobel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm a little confused. When you were talking about the certified dispenser person, then this would not be an audiologist or the otolaryngologist or whatever that, however you pronounce it.
It may be.
Mr. Wales.
It may be an audiologist or another professional, an otolaryngologist, anybody who is certified to dispense hearing aid. It may be a chiropractor, it may be a pharmacist, it may be somebody like me who's merely a hearing instrument specialist. But if they're certified by the Department of Health, they may be an audiologist. Over half of the people who are certified by the Department of Health to dispense hearing aids are, in fact, audiologists.
Representative Sanderson.
Mr. Yeah. Chair, then to follow up, what kind of education or training do people need to be certified? I know you said they could be an audiologist or somebody, but somebody else that is just dispensing and providing that service, what type of formal education or training would they have?
None.
Mr. Wales.
But they must successfully pass a practical and a written test, which is administered by the Department of Health, and it is failed most times on the first attempt by those who are taking it. It's failed by both audiologists and non-audiologists. Audiologists tend to pass a little more frequently, but they've been exempted from having to take the written portion of the test. But there's a very stringent test, and it is a test that I believe the Department of Health has adopted from the International Hearing Society, and it takes about $400, a fee of $400 to sit for the test, and like I say, it's more often failed than it's passed on the first attempt. It's a difficult test.
Representative Samuelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm not real comfortable with just having an exam to qualify these people to do that, to give that type of service or to follow up there.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ochemba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really, all we're doing is allowing them to do an exam. It's they go through the same type, a similar type of licensure within the Department of Health. Other states are doing it, and it's way cheaper. It's extremely expensive. I mean, it saves us money. I mean, we have cases where, you know, the audiologist will pick up somebody from the nursing home, whether it's by ambulance or by a van, take them to the audiologist, and then if they choose to have the hearing aid by a hearing aid dispenser, they need to go. It's a similar problem that we had with dentists and hygienists. There's a certain level of what you can do that is ample, and they just want to be reimbursed for what they're already doing. Actually, they're already allowed to do this. It's just that in statute it says only audiologists can get reimbursed by Medicaid. That's all it's doing.
Representative Samuelson.
Mr. Chair, then as I was looking at Amendment A1, it states that they can be reimbursed at the same rate as the audiologist. That I'm a little uncomfortable with that too, considering that the audiologists have you know, medical background as well as other background to be able to do this, and then having the people that just take a test and become certified actually just being paid at the same rate. It doesn't compute.
Members, let me just give you some advice. This the bill run is a Department of Health licensing bill. This is a bill involving the scope of practice, although it's under the DHS regulations or statutes, and so this will be more properly put before us on Thursday and to that bill. And so in the meantime, I suggest that there's 8 members of the committee, Mr. Wales, and they'll be called on to make a decision on Thursday. Representative Tremba, you know who we are, and I suggest you talk it up, and I think the audiologists will have a view on this, and so I'm not sure if we'll have a chance to get this all resolved. There may be a fiscal note that may be substantial or not. We don't know. This committee has no budget at all to do anything. And so the budgets that these licensing boards do are fee-based, and they're paid by the licensees. In this case, the money would come out of the medical assistance or whatever pots of money. And so if it costs money, it'll be very difficult to get this as a priority for, I think, this legislature. But it's good to discuss it. Representative Trumbo.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My take on it is actually it would save us money. Audiologists are, I mean, I have a niece that's deaf. I know what kind of money my sister spends on not only going to an audiologist, but everything else that goes with it. And there are a lot of people out there that do not need an audiologist. They just need to have the exam done by the hearing aid dispenser. And so my take on it is actually my step would be that it would save healthcare dollars, because now everybody, in order to get reimbursed, goes to the most expensive place to have it done. And having dealt with, you know, even audiologists for, you know, my niece is 22 now. I mean, I remember when she more than once was misdiagnosed, and paid the price for that for a few years in a school. So it's, you know, it's an interesting discussion.
Members, you have some homework. You get the last word, Mr. Wales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to address the councilwoman's question. Most of us who are hearing instrument dispensers do not participate in the human services, the medical assistance program, because it pays so little, and there are very few of us that do. Most of us are involved in working with people who are self-pay and with insurance companies who compensate us much more generously than does medical assistance. So I want you to know that we are doing hearing testing routinely, and people are paying for it and recognizing our services as and appreciating them. We're not asking for something special to be able to provide for hearing evaluation of people that are on medical assistance. It would be much more convenient. There would be much less transportation involved. And, Frank, you would increase the access because there are so few of us to begin with. If you reduce the pool to just those who are audiologists that are eligible to do testing, people must be transported much greater distances, and it's less convenient.
Thank you, Mr. Wales. I think that's enough time. That's all we have for time for this. Now, we do have a special bonus feature here that I was kind of caught by surprise if the acupuncturist. Yes, sir.
Am I done?
Thank you. You're done. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'll be available for anybody that needs information.
Thank you. And if the acupuncturist had a late addition, they wanted to throw in here, so if they want to come to the table. And and again, I want to, I'm trying to be a pretty inclusive chair here, but some of these things coming at the end when they were not really given privy to some of this is, this will go a bit beyond yet, but first hearing time is when people sometimes react to things and then they get buried in a huge omnibus. So welcome to the committee. And
Hi, my name is Mark McKenzie. I'm on the executive board of the Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine Association of Minnesota. I'm also the dean of the Minnesota College of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine at Northwestern. Apologize. We found out about the bill late last week, basically right when it got entered, so I apologize for the lateness of this. My understanding is that it was a housekeeping bill. As we did a little bit of research, what we came up with was that first page that I gave you. The second page was something we've talked about, but basically all in our research, what we found out in going through the bill, there are some places that there were opportunities for additional housekeeping that we felt were non-controversial items. If that is an appropriate thing for us to look at this time, then we'd like to add it. If it's not an appropriate time, then we can table it. We're okay with the amendment as is. We just thought this might be an opportunity to add some additional language.
And members, I don't think there's a copy of the amendment available.
No, I'm sorry. I only had the one.
Mr. McKenzie, so as I read the amendment, just to save us some time, and you mentioned that the second page is a bit more controversial, which I think it may be and might need some work, but I think page one, you clarify a certification standard, and then you talk about an obsolete section. Is that correct?
Correct. There were two suggestions. The bill basically has about four places that it refers to NCCAOM certification in various places within the bill. However, NCCAOM certification is not defined, and NCCAOM does offer four different certifications. Two of those certifications are appropriate for this license. The other two are not appropriate for this license as written, and that's the reason for adding that language.
Thank you. And we just have one copy. Do you have another copy with you?
I do have one more that I can give.
Would you please give it to our good staff there so they'll be able to give that to them now, and then I'll have Ms. Bonelli read that for us. I think what my comfort level is to deal with page one and to defer on page two. They seem to be relatively technical, and it's housekeeping and it's non-controversial. There's some substance in some of this work we've done, but a lot of it's very modest.
And actually, I wasn't expecting to enter the second page today at all. I actually wanted to let you know.
Great minds think alike, Mr. McKenzie. So, maybe Ms. Bonelli, do you want to read for us the amendment that we'll be offering?
Mr. Chair, this would amend the delete all amendment 1, 2175. Replaces subdivision 17 NCCAOM certification means a certification granted by the NCCAOM to a person who has met the standards of competence established for either NCCAOM certification in acupuncture or NCCAOM certification in oriental medicine.
And then so renumbering, and then I think the second one, too, there was a deletion of a, the second half of that. Ms. Minnelli, do you want to read that for us, too?
Delete subdivision 5, licensure by equivalency during transitional period.
And this, it's
just repealer.
And Mr. McKenzie, the transitional period has now lapsed, and so now you're into the real...
Correct. It ended in 1997 in our discussions with the Board of Medical Practice. They were the ones that indicated to us that now would be a good time to get that out of there as well.
Yeah.
So we were just passing that information forward.
Always happy to have clean statutes, Mr. McKenzie. So I'll move the amendment that you've heard read. Are there any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Oppose? Well, you got 2 out of 3. That's pretty good.
Great.
Thanks,
thank
Mr.
you.
Mr. McKenzie, the motion prevails. Amendment's adopted, and you're free to go.
I appreciate it.
Is there any further amendments to be brought before the committee? I want to thank everybody for their work. I think we've got a relatively good piece of housekeeping. I want to point out the next meeting in the subcommittee for those who have stayed the whole thing. We should have some kind of award for people who sat through the whole thing. We're meeting March 4th after session. We'll be taking up the DHS licensure, soon to be omnibus bill of various topics. You'll want to watch the introductions for the various parts. I'll be rolled into that. Is there any more discussion from the audience about any points that we've missed or we should take up on this bill? Seeing none, I'll do that. We'll now take a vote on the moving the bill to the, I'll renew my motion that this bill be recommended to pass and be taken to full committee. Discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The motion prevails, the bill is moved on. And we need to move some bill, some minutes. We have last 2 minutes. Mr. Notremba, do you want to pick one of those sets of minutes? And the meeting of February 23rd. Any questions about those? Mr. Notremba moves those minutes. All those in favor of the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Minutes are adopted for them. Representative Samuelson, do you want to move the minutes to 24th?
So moved.
Thank you. Any questions about that? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
The minutes are adopted. And I believe they're adopted. And I, any further business, we want to drag this out a little longer. Have we had enough? 5:30, is that a good time to quit?
Yes.
We're adjourned. Thank you.